Steve, thanks. It's us. It's Bill and Wendy. Hi, everybody. It's Wednesday. Week's almost half over, which is nice. We got a little boost there.
Happy Humper.
Happy Humper.
Sounds like I bullied you into saying that.
You forced me to say that against my will. You know what? You brought something up when you walked in today, and I don't have the answer to this. Traffic was abysmal this morning, and it really doesn't make sense because it was just rain. That's all we had was some rain.
I thought I might not get here actually today.
All of us, Steve. Right. Every one of us.
It was really horrendous. I could see if there's a blizzard. The only thing that I can think about is a lot of the right lanes were underwater. So a lot of people merged, and that may have slowed things down.
No, I didn't have that at all, because I kept looking, trying to figure out if there was something I was missing in the equation, because it was wall-to-wall traffic from pretty much the time I left my house until I got here. It took me an extra hour and 5 minutes to get the same distance. And then at some point, and we've talked about this before with traffic, you reach a part, for me it was on Lakeshore Drive, where there's just no traffic. It's wall-to-wall, bumper-to-bumper traffic, and then it's as though somebody was there going, okay, and you go. But there isn't anyone there doing that.
Yeah, and I don't understand when it's completely backed up, and then you're thinking there's an accident or something. So when you get up to where it's backed up, then it's free and easy. I know merging freaks people out.
Right.
Because you know why?
Not sure.
Jerks won't let people in.
There's that.
Just let somebody in. I let people in all the time. What is the advantage of not letting someone in? I take Lower Wacker home every day, and there's construction randomly. Like every fourth day, there's construction where it goes down to one lane.
Right.
And the etiquette is each person lets a car in like every other, and then bing, bang, boom, it moves.
To somebody who's merging on, you mean?
Yeah.
On the other hand, though, you know, Bill, you don't get on. You're not on the Edens, right?
No.
So I come in on the Edens, and to get into the local lanes on the Kennedy, you're in the left lane of the Edens, and it backs up, starts backing up, you know, to Peterson or something.
Way
that
deep.
Left lane is very slow.
Yeah.
And then you got people who zoom by you in the regular lanes and then cut in, Wendy.
At the last
second.
That's
a little different. Yeah.
I know, but that's they should
different.
Be
Well, you let them in because
shot.
What are you going to do? But
so you're advocating
no, I'm not.
That these people be shot.
But
Glenn
there's,
Beck.
You know, when you see that, no, I'm not.
Glenn Beck called. He's interested in talking to you after.
All right, good. Some press for the show, Bill.
Right.
But you know, when the lane comes down, it merges into one. I also cannot stand when people merge too early.
Right.
Like get to the merge point and then everyone lets every one car in. That's how it's supposed
Should
to be.
Or the people who merge early and then are furious for you.
Yeah, but don't merge early then.
For going to the merge point, right.
All right, if you're walking down a street and you see a roadblock in the right lane, you're just walking down the sidewalk and the right part of the sidewalk is
blocked off. Yeah.
Do you get in the left lane like a mile down the road? No, you walk in the right lane until it cuts off and then you go around it.
Yeah.
That's how it should be driving.
Yeah. Except now people are texting and the driving is secondary. They're just texting, so they don't see the roadblock until the last second. And then they text their friends, there's a roadblock coming. I have to switch lanes. I'll get back to you in a few minutes.
And then they text Allstate and say, I've been in an accident.
I'm about to be in an accident.
I saw that happen on Lower Wacker where it's moving bumper to bumper. It is not moving at all for quite some time. And I hear this big crash, and the car behind me got rear-ended because somebody was texting.
Of course.
I saw the guy texting.
I know. That's constant. And that actually adds to the traffic, too, because you got people saying, I'm in traffic. I got time to text. And then
cars are
jumping in front of them left and right.
Put your foot on the brake if you're texting. If you're in bumper to bumper, put your foot on the brake. This guy was just inching forward as he was like, hello.
Right.
Of course you're going to rear end somebody.
That's not going to work. But it still doesn't answer the question on a day like today where you have some rain. And I will give you what you said, Wendy, and it's true. There are some areas where maybe part of a lane is flooded a little bit, but I didn't come across that at all. All I came across was bumper-to-bumper traffic for the entire ride.
You know, and what I find is that the traffic reporters during the rain, they don't do a very good Mary Vanderbilt up here complaining.
Uh-oh. You don't want trouble for Mary.
She's got her hands on her hips. I hate it when people complain about the traffic. Sit down, Mary. Come here.
Come here. Oh, that sounds really... Come here. Sit on my lap.
Right. I did. Tell not Santa say what you that. Want for Christmas.
She's got to get some headphones here just a sec.
All right.
All right. But seriously, I really don't understand. And I've heard all morning long, Mary was saying, traffic's really bad today. Travel times are outrageous. They were. But why?
I can't figure it out.
I think that's. I think it's a plot by the traffic reporters to keep themselves
employed.
Right, Mary?
You guys always have to talk about this every time it rains. Every time it rains, it's going to be terrible traffic.
Well, why?
But that's we can't figure it out.
Snow, I guess.
You're supposed to slow down when it rains.
No.
A lot of people have an issue they can't see as good. You know, it's but it happens all the time. Plus, it's the day after, you know, the holiday week.
Some 2 days after.
Mary, I know, but people always take that extra day.
You're in an April.
So it's the bit.
You're a traffic apologist. That's what you are, Mary.
No, I'm just saying this happens every time, and then you guys come out. Oh my gosh!
But the because people always say, but the visibility is worse. But for me, I can't speak for everybody. The visibility for me is better on a day like today because you don't have to contend with the sun blocking you out.
Right.
And but the windows were fogging up.
Well, I know where the road goes.
Right.
You
I'm
do.
Familiar with it.
Right.
Well, everybody does. You know, it's the same. But what do I always say on days like this? Take public transportation.
Take public transportation.
And who listens?
I don't
no
know
one.
How. I don't know how to take public transportation.
Well, I have an excuse because I don't. The trains don't run as early when I come in. There are no trains. Right. So I have to drive. But, of course, there's not as much traffic. But, yeah, you guys take the train.
Although, it's funny, my sister-in-law came in from Peoria.
What if I could? I love the train.
And she was astounded that traffic was in full force, rush hour at 3 o'clock.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
That has changed where rush hour starts at, like, 5:30 a.m.
Yes.
And it goes till 6:30 or 7.
It does. And honestly, when we worked the shift where we got out at noon, if I got in my car to go outbound on the Eisenhower or Stevenson by 2:30,
yeah.
I was fine.
Yeah.
After 2:30, it's
a mess.
It's
oh, it's
already
worse
started.
Now it's 12:30. If I leave at 12:30 here instead of 12 o'clock, I'm already backed up at Austin.
What do we do?
Well, it's Obama. You know it's Obama.
Take public transportation.
That doesn't matter. I'm not doing that.
And they're
that.
Saying everyone's leaving the state? I don't think so.
That's what's causing the traffic. Everybody's leaving. All right, we need to take a break. We'll solve other problems with the world. If you want to jump in, please do. We're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
It's Phil Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. Our phone number, 312-981-7200, phone or text. And we got a text. I was referring to everybody let one car in and so on and so forth. You tell two friends. And we use Fabergé shampoo.
Yeah.
Somebody said that I am describing the zipper merge.
That's, I've never heard it called that, but that's kind of accurate, isn't it?
Totally. I got probably five texts saying I call it the zipper merge, but evidently a lot of people do. And it because, you know, the little pieces of the zipper come together one by one by one to make a smooth zip.
I call that the you go, I go move. But zipper merge is better.
What if you don't have a Yugo?
Oh, I just assumed everybody had a Yugo at this point. Best car on the road today.
What happened to the Yugo?
I don't know.
Long gone.
I don't know.
It's called the zipper merge. That's what should happen on the Edens merge, too. Studies show it's much faster. Use all the available real estate and then take turns at the merge point. Because seriously, if you're walking down the sidewalk and you see a construction horse on the right side of the sidewalk, you're not going to get on the left side of the sidewalk a mile down the road. You're going to walk where you walk, and then when that comes, you're going to scoot over.
But you're operating under the belief that everybody's playing by the rules when in reality, as we said, a lot of people dart in at the last second. Other people don't let other people in. So,
but there could be no one darting in at the last second if you're all filling up
there. Sure.
Although I did see someone on the Eisenhower on the way home last night when the torrential downpour started.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought it was okay to drive on the right shoulder with his hazard lights on.
Mm.
And I
was
wanted
nothing wrong with him or his car? Because I don't.
Oh
think
no, he was going probably 80 miles an hour.
Oh, great!
And it was like a little Honda or something.
Yeah.
But he thought, I'm going to put my flashers on and I'm going to go zipping. And I know it wasn't an unmarked car because the car was in terrible shape.
Oh,
but
really?
I was hoping against hope that there was a police officer and they can use the shoulders.
Right.
And I thought, I was hoping he would get nabbed. But people never get nabbed when you want them to.
No, it's unfortunate.
It's only really when you're doing something minor and then the Mars lights go off.
Right.
And on the Stevenson, it scares me when people do that because buses can use the shoulder now.
Right.
So there was this one cabbie who pulled to the left shoulder. And just as he pulled over, a bus was hauling butt down there.
Really?
And bus slammed on the brakes. I think the cabbie messed up his beaded seat.
Yeah.
And then all called it a good day.
That's it.
We have some fogging tips because when the rain happens, sometimes you don't see really well. Robert, you have some fogging avoidance rules.
Yeah, when I heard you earlier saying that your windows get all foggy, what I was saying is that on your dash, you have a setting, and it's a little button that shows like an arrow going like in a U position. And when you have your air conditioning on, you push that button in, and what that does, it recycles the air inside the cabin when your cab is, you know, when the inside of your vehicle is cool. Mm-hmm. In the wintertime, you take that option off because you want the clean air to come out from the outside in your vehicle. Therefore, it won't allow your windows to fog up. It's getting fresh air from the outside with the heat, because what creates the moisture on your windows, obviously, you know, the heat with cold and everything. But I see a lot of people always drive around with the windows completely fogged down.
It's like they're in a bubble.
Right.
Or a cloud.
And like, it's just a little button you push, recycle if your AC is on, push that little button there, and it recycles the air inside.
I was kind of going to yell at you at first, Robert, because I was going to say, how long do you think I've been driving? But I only put that recycle button on after, like, if you get in the car and it's really hot and you put the air on, yeah, I pop it out because right, you want it to cool quickly. Once it's cool, I always pop it in. But I didn't think about recycling the air on the inside to keep the fog at bay.
Right. And also, what helps a lot, too, is all cars usually have a cabin filter, which sits kind of behind your dash, and that can get clogged up with a lot of like leaves and dust and all the particles and all that. That would also won't allow the air to circulate either. It's called a cabin filter. That needs to be replaced when you do like oil changes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That cabin filter should be changed also, because that gets full of, you know, all the gunk or whatever it may be, and bugs and so on and so forth. And that won't allow the air to circulate either in your vehicle properly.
You know your stuff, Robert. How come you're so knowledgeable about this?
Because I learned this the hard way. Because I used to drive around when I was a little younger with my windows all fogged up.
Yeah.
I realized what that little button was for. And I had somebody tell me, why don't you push this button? This is what it's for. And I was like, oh.
It's okay. That simple.
It's that simple. And then I realized even in the wintertime when you drive around and windows are really foggy, if you have that button pushed in, what you're doing is circulating the moisture of your breathing and the heat and all that, and that's what builds the moisture inside from the outside being cold.
So I wonder if foggy mold would work.
Hmm.
Which one?
The foggy mold.
One of our proud sponsors.
I'm sure it could.
I mean, try that.
You can use Rain-X, too. That's really good, too.
Rain-X? Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert, where were you last night? I wish you were my neighbor, because I couldn't take the new car to work because I don't know where the gas cap fuel door is.
Really?
Seriously, yeah. I had to get out the manual. It's on the steering wheel. That's a new place.
Oh.
Isn't that weird?
That is weird.
Thanks for the tips, Mr. Fogg.
Have a good guy.
I will. As soon as I get home.
And Jim's out of town, so that's kind of weird. All right, let's take a quick break. Steve has the news and then more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
I say Chicago has got everything you need. Say Chicago has got everything you need. We've got a great lake and go play the streets.
Bill, I didn't know you could sing.
That's nice of you, Wendy. I'm taking voice lessons. I'm doing my best. I appreciate that.
You got the blues in you, man.
Yeah, I do have them in me.
Musician and songwriter and educator and humanitarian Fernando Jones in the studio with us. How are you, Mr. Jones?
I am doing fantastic, Wendy, and I'm doing even more fantastic, Bill.
Thank you.
I didn't know much about you, I will be honest. And then a neighborhood mom, Michelle Demanchuk, said,
yes,
do you know about this blues camp? And okay, I said, don't know anything about it. So we went to blueskids.com, and there's a little place where you can audition to get in the blues camp.
Right.
My son, Michael Mack, said to me, you know what, I'm not really into the blues. I said, well, too bad. Go and learn some things, and maybe it'll change your mind. And your Blues Kids Camp has opened a whole world to Michael Mack.
Well, that's great. That's great. And your son, we call him Blues Red. That's his nickname, in addition to what Mama calls him. And that's what it's all about, giving a kid an opportunity who may or may not know they even need an opportunity.
And that's what's so amazing about this Blues Kids Camp. It's a nonprofit, Blues Kids Foundation, a nonprofit charitable organization.
Yes.
Founded by you, Fernando
yes.
Jones.
Yes.
You're a professor at Columbia College, and you just decided to give people a chance, kids that maybe don't know much about the blues, to educate them. And lo and behold, all these kids are virtuosos now.
Yeah, well, you know, it gives them a network, and they will have an opportunity that me and my contemporaries didn't have, because by them having their own network, they will not necessarily have to depend on club owners to give them an opportunity to play, because they have each other. And the diversity of the kids that play the blues that have come through the blues camp is beyond words. One of the little guys is on Broadway, Brandon Niederauer. You know, you got Ray Gorin. This had a record produced by Eddie Kramer, who was the engineer for Jimi Hendrix. The teen queen of the blues, Savannah Cohen, is from Blues Camp, and she's from, I believe, Oregon. And the list just goes on and on and on and on. And the camp is free. I think that's the greatest part about it, in addition to us having world-class instructors. And I wanted to make it free because I wanted it to be a priceless experience. And I didn't want to prejudice the camp by discriminating against parents who might be wealthy. And I didn't want to discriminate against parents who may be middle class or may not have the resources if they're, you know, if a price tag were affixed to it.
So if someone's listening right now and they have a kid who plays guitar or brass or harmonica or keyboards, and they want to find out more about this free Blues Kids Camp that happens at Columbia College downtown.
Yes.
It's the second week of July, I believe.
Right, July 11th through 15th. All they have to do is go to blueskids.com. We don't have any discipline concerns, and we have about 20 slots left for kids throughout North America. We will have student musicians that will be here from the country, of Columbia, South America, the governor from Bolivar, in Colombia will be here. The mayor of Cartagena and the mayor of Mampo, Colombia, will be here as well.
Blues and really so big forth. There in South America?
Well, it will be as soon as my plane lands.
How does that happen, these dignitaries from all these foreign countries?
Well, you know what? Blues has such an international cultural hold or root hold on music. And anytime people that are musicians, they always want to go back to some sort of a root to it. Just as if you were in medicine, you know, you would probably go study in Egypt and understand medicine from that perspective in order to be competent and effective in the year 2016 here in Chicago. And so music is no exception.
You have a big gala that's going on, and it's important to mention this. It's this
yes.
Saturday, June 4th, because this is how you keep the Blues Kids
right.
Camp free.
This is how we keep the Blues Kids Camp free or priceless, in addition to our donors and our friends like the Fort Martin Fund, Micro Simi, and the Mary Barnes Donnelly Family Foundation, and so on and so forth. Our fundraiser is this Saturday, June 4th, at the Chicago Federation of Musicians Union Hall. And part of the proceeds, if you are a member of Kappa Alpha Psi, part of the proceeds will go to help support our Guide Right program through the Edward G. Irvin Foundation.
How old were you when you first picked up your guitar, Fernando
Jones? I picked up my first guitar when I was 4 years old, and I wanted to be like my big brother Greg Jones, who was like Prince. He played everything, and he said the magic phrase that all big brothers say, "Don't bother my stuff." And 40-something years later, here I am.
What's in a kid's mindset? You know, I guess rock makes sense and hip-hop makes mm-hmm. sense and rap makes sense, but a kid who's going the blues direction, what's different in that kid's mind than those
other
streets?
Well, you know what? And that's a very good question that you ask. If a person is studying guitar, they play guitar-centric music.
Mm-hmm.
And the obvious choice in a guitar-centric person's mind is rock and roll, because it's guitar heavy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're playing a brass instrument, you'll probably gravitate towards jazz or like some 70s funk. What's going through that kid's mind is, how long will it take for me to be able to play like somebody else, and who can I play with,
mm-hmm.
and who will give me a chance? And that's what goes through every kid's mind. And then a part of you think that you're weird if you live in a situation where there are no other musicians that are around. And so that's what Blues Kids and the Blues Kids Foundation is all about, giving kids you know, who are like mind, an opportunity to be with each other. And so this year, the blues camp at Columbia College Chicago is going to be so phenomenal because we're going to have a game truck this year. So we're going to engage the kids in every way we can, in addition to them being able to play music from roughly 8 o'clock in the morning all the way to about 2 o'clock. We're going to have a game truck that comes on Wednesday. We have an annual white party fundraiser where we wear our festive white clothes and the kids play.
Not just for white people. It's just you wear white.
There were some problems last year with that. But so people understand.
Come on and we'll give you a white shirt and you can be whatever you want to be.
I probably shouldn't say this, but I have a very pale-complected, redheaded kid, and white people don't look good in white clothes.
You know what? Wear it anyway, and I believe in you. You know, Puffy Combs is not the only guy who can have a white party.
Right.
So we're going to have one. We're pushing blues to a whole new level and the level that it deserves. And then the kids will wrap up at the end of Blues Camp with a real nice performance at where else? Drum roll, please. The Hard Rock Cafe.
Oh,
so we're killing. We're killing.
It's such a good thing. And again, my son didn't know he even liked blues. Mm-hmm. And then going to this camp just opened his eyes. What was really cool, too, is people from all different ethnic backgrounds come together for one theme, and it's music. And they learn to jam. Mm-hmm. And what I like about you is you don't let... A lot of times if there's some hot dog kid who's playing all the guitar solos, you will like put them back in their place and say, you know, you gotta, I think your analogy was the blues and great musicianship is like a salad.
Exactly.
You got the lettuce.
Exactly, which is the foundation of the piece. And if you're the guitar, you don't want to have too many olives or too much salt or too much pepper in it because that takes away from the whole piece of the salad. So of the lettuce. So the lettuce will be whatever the core of the band is. And if you're soloing, you know, maybe an olive here, maybe an olive there. If
right.
you're playing saxophone solo, you know, maybe a crouton here, a crouton
there. Anchovies on the side, Fernando, for people who don't like
them, correct? Yeah. Well, that would be like a guitar playing out of like 5 amplifiers with 62 guitar pedals. So that would overwhelm that situation.
Sure. Of course.
Yeah, nobody likes anchovies.
When I think of blues music, it's late at night. I think about it, it's 11 o'clock at night, or it's midnight, or it's 1 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Is it harder to play blues music in the morning?
You know what? If you have a gift, you can play the blues on the moon. And that's what my job is, for you to have me here in the morning and for you to arrange for a space shuttle so I can demonstrate playing the blues on
the
moon.
All right,
we're going to take a quick break. Fernando Jones is his name, musician, songwriter, educator, humanitarian. If there are any parents listening right now who have musicians, and do you need to be completely virtuoso? Or can
well,
you
no.
Just be
you
starting
know what?
Out?
When we started, the idea was to have intermediate and advanced players. And then these two little guys, Carlton and Peyton, came in. They were underage. Their guitars were bigger than they were. And so we developed a component for entry-level blues kids, you know, but we don't tell anybody.
Right.
They kind of seek us
out. Sure. All right.
So go to Chicago, go to blueskids.com and you can find a link and register your kid. All you have to do is make a video, upload it to YouTube, and you look at it and get back to them if there are some spaces open. And we'll continue talking about it next. It's Bill Leff, Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN. We're talking to Fernando Jones, musician, songwriter, educator, professor at Columbia College. You mentioned your brother liked Prince.
Right,
you're a big
Prince. Yes,
fan
too. You know what? I wished that I could have had an opportunity to have met Prince and to play with him because he was a consummate musician, and he's a musician's musician. And I mourned probably until all the way up until about last week of his loss. And that was very, personal to me. And sometimes we have stars that we like, and when somebody else loses something, it doesn't mean anything to you. But when that happened, that hurt me as if he was my brother.
And he was so diverse in his talent. I mean,
yes.
He did blues, he did funk,
yes.
He did jazz.
Yes.
And your music, I've seen you perform. You're kind of all over the board,
yes,
too.
Yes. You know, I'm a blues man by... DNA and genetics, but I grew up during a time where, and I started playing in 1968, so the influences came from everywhere, and I think better musicians have other influences and can adapt, and then you become not only, you go beyond just being a blues man, you go on to be a musician, and I'm a blues man, but I'm a musician and I love music and I can pretty much play anything because going back to that salad analogy, I know how not to get in the way. And I think that's the thing that Prince and all the people that worked with him, like Morris Hayes, who is a friend of mine, who was his music director. Morris Hayes even played with Michael Bublé. So, you know, going from Prince to Michael Bublé to, you know. But if you're a musician, you can do that.
I hate to admit I love Bublé. I didn't want to like Bublé, and he is so good.
He's on top of his game, you know. And sometimes we don't like people when they're good because they remind us of how far we have to go to get to that level. But yeah. It's okay to like people.
Who's, I know this is an unfair question, but I'm going to ask anyway, who's the best that's ever been when it comes to blues music?
Well, I mean, that is probably a mathematical, impossible question
you can't
to answer.
Say.
But since we're mentioning, you know, Prince does have a blues album. I don't know if it ever be released. And if you watch his, what do you call it, Las Vegas DVD, and he does a blues song with just, I think he has a Morris Hayes is playing keyboards, he has Rhonda Smith playing bass, and Sheila E. playing drums.
Yeah.
Purple Rain is probably the greatest blues record in the last 25 years.
Do you
years.
Think it is? Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. That's the blues.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, the cliche answers, you could always say Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and things like that. Mm-hmm. Of course, I say I like Muddy Waters when I want to love, and I like Howlin' Wolf when I want to be loved. You know, so, and hopefully somebody will say I'm in that category one day because that's what you want.
You know, blues sounds so different. I was a big fan of Stevie Ray Vaughan, but that was a whole different type of blues. He felt it, but it's not the old school blues like Elmore James or something like that.
But you know what? I always say if you show me a purist, I'll show you a hypocrite. And blues is supposed to evolve. And I think one of the disadvantages that blues has is that it has failed to publicly evolve. And we as musicians, especially in Chicago, we have consumed the Kool-Aid to believe that people come to Chicago and they want to hear the same songs that were written 50 years ago. And that is not true. You know, a few of my contemporaries, myself, Ronnie Baker Brooks, Taranzo Cannon, guys that go out and play the Kinz Report night after night, all original tunes, and have the crowd rocking, you know.
Yeah.
And I think you can't sell your audience short because people are intelligent and they want to hear things that are new. And there's always open season on new ideas.
So to make it, as you said, the problem is to make it publicly evolve. That's the way to fix that
problem. Oh, you
problem.
Have to. I mean, look, you know, jazz is you know, straight ahead jazz and bebop jazz and a lot of these different guys that are still playing this Coltrane-esque music.
Mm-hmm.
They, and Wynton Marsalis and those guys, they are successful and have a big career because of the popularity of people like Kenny G and Ronnie Laws. And those are people who the jazz purists, they hated those guys.
Yeah.
But the fact that they had both ends of the spectrum, you know, contemporary and the old or the traditional, whatever traditional is, gave it a market. And that's what the blues needs. The blues needs, going back to Prince, the blues needs some young person, you know, that can dance, look good, sing perfectly, can do splits, can entertain, and also can deliver a show.
Bill's your man.
I'm here for you.
Right on, Bill.
I'm ready to take that
I
mantle.
See your heels. I see your high heels.
All right.
And maybe your color could be orange or something since
like
you don't want to wear white.
I will go the orange route.
Yeah, you go orange.
Tangerine Bill.
Orange, tangerine, or orange.
All right, I'm in. I like it.
All right, he's Fernando Jones.
Or sherbet.
I like that. Yep. If any parents are listening or any kids that are out of school, you got to get involved in this Blues Kids Camp. It's just something, once you taste it, you're going to want to keep tasting that. And blueskids.com. July 11th through the 15th audition. A few spaces still available.
And you will get Parent of the Year guaranteed if you send your kid to Blues Camp.
They do start loving it, and you have the Blues Parents too. Which one of these days I got to do?
They have.
This.
We're probably the only camp in the United States of America that has a Blues Mama and Blues Daddy band inside of Blues Camp, and it too is free. You know, so
what does that mean? I'm not sure.
That means that if you are a parent or guardian of a kid in Blues Camp Chicago and you're up in Chicago for that week and you want to have an opportunity to be the opening act for your little star kid, you can be involved. And you also will perform at the Hard Rock Cafe at the end of the year. At the end of the cycle, you will also participate at our white party at the Glessner House Mansion on Thursday, and you will also perform Wednesday night of that week at Reggie's Rock Club. So you get a chance to be your own little rock star and your own little adult blues camp here.
I got to do it this year. Maybe in Nashville. We're going to the Nashville
camp.
Oh,
yeah, we've got a camp in that. We also have a camp in Japan, in Tokyo, Japan. So you can come to Blues Camp Tokyo, Japan. You can come to Blues Camp Nashville. And we will have a blues camp in New York City next year.
I know we don't have time, but blues in Japan, is that a big thing?
Once again,
it's getting there.
When my plane lands, Mr. Blues Vato.
Yes, it all changes.
All right, I get it. All right,
and the big gala is this Saturday, June 4th. Information up at blueskids.com.
Blueskids.com. Right on the homepage, you can get tickets, and proceeds will benefit the Blues Kids Foundation. And if you're a member of Kappa Alpha Psi, it will go towards our Guide Right program by way of founder Edward Giles Irvin Foundation.
Fernando Jones, thank you so much. Rock on, or blues on, shall I say.
Right on.
Spill F, it's Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN. Look who's here.
It's Dr. John Duffy, the author of The Available Parent, and the most knowledgeable person on the planet when it comes to the relationships between parents and children. John, I know that's a lot to live up to, but I voted, just one vote, and you won. So congratulations.
Thank you, Bill.
There's a story that Wendy and I talked about in the news yesterday, and that's this kid, this four-year-old kid that was at the zoo and then climbed into the gorilla enclosure. Thank you very much.
Exhibit.
And things did not end well for the gorilla.
True.
Now, we watched the video, and this child doesn't even look a little bit alarmed that he's in with a gorilla and the dangers.
He did scream. My
sister
again.
There was a moment of screaming, yeah.
Reiterated, the kids screamed.
Right.
And I'm thinking he was in shock, but when you look at him, it looks like he's just kind of looking at the gorilla going, okay, what you got for me?
Yeah.
Right. And he might have been in shock from the fall. I mean, you know, we forget the fact that this kid fell like 20 feet before, you know, this all happened.
Yeah. So a couple of questions. Question number one, you kind of just answered, is it possible to be that close to an animal that could untwist your head if it wanted to and not be afraid? And question two is, what are the long-term effects with a kid like this? That's a traumatic day right there. Is that something that child will remember for the rest of his life?
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
If he doesn't have vivid memories of it, I don't know if you remember 4 years old. I remember seeing Santa Claus. So I know I manufactured that somewhere.
Yeah.
He will hear about this and he will probably move it around a little bit, but there isn't, you know, in his mind, he'll probably shift to the, you know, what it was like. But this kid, unlike, you know, me and my Santa Claus moment, he's got video footage that he can look back on,
right,
you know, when he is 20 years old,
right,
and see exactly how this went. So, you know, I'm curious to see the impact this has over the long term on this kid. It's a great question.
Yeah. How do parents, when there's so many stories where kids are in the news and then other kids, of course, if you're near a TV or a radio or the internet, you get little bits and pieces of those stories. So if you're a parent to any four-year-old or kid of like age, what do you say to those kids about what just took
place?
Don't
wander from me.
Stay close to me, right?
There's a lesson. The lesson is don't wander from me. And I suppose the idea of giving them a little comfort is, the reason we're hearing this is it hardly ever happens. This isn't something that happens at zoos all the time. It hardly ever happens. So we don't have to worry about it. But to Wendy's point, don't wander from me and we'll be sure this doesn't happen. It's a great, like, kind of final lesson. Like,
yeah.
Stay close.
And a lot of people are blaming the mom.
Yes.
I don't know how much blame can go on a mom. The kid was videotaped by someone else saying, I'm going to go in that water. I want to go in that water. The mom, as we discussed yesterday, Bill, a kid says that. You go, all right, no, you're not. And you think that's a done deal. You don't think anything's going to go beyond. This kid crawled over a planter and a 3-foot fence, which is not really that high, but he shouldn't be going in the back area and then falling 15 to 20 feet into the enclosure.
Agreed. And there's so much disagreement online. Obviously, you know, so many people are talking about it. So many people want to blame the mom. But, you know, we've all been in situations. I think we've all had that grocery store panic, right?
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
You know, where it's like, oh my God, I took my eyes off him for a second and now he's gone, you know? And this just happens this is that situation on steroids. It's a massive, you know, newsworthy situation, but the circumstances probably aren't that wildly different in that she probably took her eyes off him because she figured, well, he's certainly not going to do what he's saying he's going to do.
Right. Who would
it's
going to
be
that?
Right, of course, right? Right. You know, so here's the one instance in a million where, in fact, the kid actually, you know, sticks to his word, climbs over into the enclosure, and now we've got this huge problem, which is tragic. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I'm sick that the gorilla had to die, but in the end, it's really, really tough for me to judge the parents. I don't know what was going on right at that moment. They may have four kids at the same time at the zoo, and they've got to keep their eyes on an army, you know, whereas, you know, some of us just watch one or two, and it's easier, you know, so it's tough to judge.
I was thinking about the parent angle, too, not just in that story, but there was a story about the kid that was playing in the river, and then his sister went in to try to save him, and they both drowned.
In Kankakee, that's
awful.
Terrible.
So wretched. So awful.
Yeah.
So, of course, that's going to be on the parents' heads for the rest of their life. Their mind, you know, what could have happened differently for this to not happen. Do you ever recover from that? You don't, do you?
No. I worked years ago with a man who lost his teenage son who on graduation night went swimming in the lake with a couple of buddies and got pulled out and they drowned. It was 20 years later when I saw him, and he presented as if it had happened yesterday. I mean, he, honest to God, sure. I mean, just absolutely traumatized, ruined.
Did he have other children?
Yes.
Okay, because that's something, you know, we've talked about this. I don't know if we try to depress each other during commercial breaks a lot, but
yeah, it's
like,
a game we play.
We
Let's see who can out-depress the other.
But
yeah.
We said, how could you recover? You don't know that you could, but if you have other children, you kind of have to pull it together and survive so the family keeps going.
He absolutely did. He had to survive. He had to work. He had, which is probably a blessing, right, that you have to move on.
Of course.
And and what he did, and I always think that it's important in situations like that to create some kind of ritual. He created this foundation and this fundraiser in his son's name, and that's what he hangs his hat on to this day, all these years later, is, you know, he collects, you know, a couple $100,000 a year in his kid's name and creates these scholarships.
That's
and these
nice.
Kids come in. Yeah. So I think that kind of ritual, it certainly doesn't bring your child back. It softens the blow a little bit, and it makes it feel like it wasn't all for naught.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. John Duffy in the studio with us, clinical psychologist, author of The Available Parent, number one best-selling book. You can reach him at drjohnduffy.com. You have a podcast that is, I said it very Valley
like
Girl
rich
like
people.
Podcast.
That's the way rich people say it.
That's right. I've got to get used to that.
WGN Plus. You can go to WGNplus.com. You're going to be part of our podcasting empire here at WGN. When
so
does
excited.
That happen?
So excited. That should be happening in the next few days here. And the podcast is a whole lot of fun. I'm talking to just kind of regular people who have gone through some kind of struggle or another and are either in the midst of it or are through it. And it is unbelievable how inspiring people's stories are. And these are regular people who've just been going through something. And one thing that struck me is when I started, I said, you know, hey, we don't have to use your real name. I've said that to 15 people, and every single person said, no, use my real name. And at least four or five of them have said, tell people to contact me if they're suffering from ADD or depression or anxiety. You know, so
people want to help people.
People want to help. Yeah, people want to help. People want to share their stories because they think it's going to affect other people in a positive way. So it's been kind of this inspiration to me.
Yeah.
Surprising in a way how encouraging and hopeful stories are that start really, really dark, you know? Yeah.
Right.
So there is light at the end of the tunnel on almost all tunnels, right?
Almost all tunnels. The one thing I've learned is what I'm always looking for in my clients and in people that are guests on the podcast is movement. So if somebody's kind of sitting still, oh, I've been playing this role as a victim for years and years, and it's really hard for me to get out of it, that worries me. Whereas if somebody can be darkly depressed, but if they're moving and they're trying different things, you know, I'm going to try to get a job, I'm going to go back to school, I'm going to, you know, do Pilates or yoga or something, that movement suggests like, yeah, you're going to find your way out of this.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm not a tunnel expert, John, but I think by virtue of it being a tunnel, there has to be an exit at the other end or else it's a cave, right?
I think by
positive.
Definition, that's exactly right.
Mr.
Right.
Pretty
Left.
Sure. I'm almost positive. All right, we'll take a quick break and then more with Dr. John Duffy. Give us a call if you have a question or a comment. We're at 312-981-7200. John is extremely good at answering those questions. So more in a moment. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Wish you were handier around the house? Learn how to tackle those DIY projects with some help from local home experts. You can do it with Weekend Workbench Sunday mornings at 11 on WGN-TV. 312-981-7200 is the number to call to talk to Dr. John Duffy. Bill, we got a text before Dr. Duffy even walked in the studio.
People have some sort of ESP when it comes to you, John. I don't understand it. But some very good questions have come across, in particular this one.
Please ask how we can help our teen make friends. It's tough.
It's tough. I think this is really tricky and really painful for teens and for parents, and we get really involved in it. And the first thing I usually assess, by the way, is there some kind of social deficit? You know, I worked with one kid years ago who said, I know I come across weird. I've got to fix that, you know. Mm-hmm. But most kids have the social skills they need. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of putting themselves out there and, you know, reaching out to people. But there's a confidence issue, too, and there's some anxiety affiliated with it. We were talking a moment ago about how texting can alleviate some of that anxiety because you can just reach out to a group of people in a group text and say, hey, I'm planning to go to see this movie this weekend. Anybody up for that? So that I usually encourage that, and every once in a while, in session, somebody will take me up on that and get a yes. You know, even if it's four no's, they get a yes, and
sure.
And that carries them, you know, maybe to the next social thing. But I think as a parent, you also want to get to understand, okay, so why are you not reaching out socially, or why do you feel disconnected socially? Because often there's anxiety under that. I don't want to be rejected. I don't want to be blown off. That hurts too much. I'd rather sit home and watch Netflix.
Yeah.
My kids like to stay home, and Jim and I, of course, wish they'd go out sometime so we could have the house to ourselves sometime. But they have a lot of stress going on in school and a lot of busy, hectic schedules. And so that is their downtime. They want to chill.
And there's that too, right? You know, that downtime can be really self-regulating. And we parents, our anxiety sometimes gets the best of us. And we press, like we want to push our kids out the door.
Go do something.
Exactly. And sometimes a little incubation is not the end of the world. You know, like a couple of weekends at home, not the end of the world. Eventually, your kid wants to connect. No kid doesn't want to connect. Double negative, but I think it's true.
Tell me more about that kid. You said that a kid approached you, and I don't know the age of this child, but he said, I know that I'm perceived as being different.
Yeah.
What do I do to fix that? What sort of advice do you give a kid who realizes that and doesn't know what to do to make things right?
One thing, when you have the privilege of doing what I do, you can learn from other kids. So I worked with a guy recently, a senior in high school, who looks back on his middle school years, recognizes, oh, I was annoying. And so what he did is he paid attention to people's reactions, and he realized, oh, I talk too much. I'm going to talk way less. So he spent his first couple years in high school just scaling back, saying fewer things, and he realized, okay, people are responding to that. People are reaching out to me instead of me just annoying them. So part of it is just calming down enough to have the insight to recognize how you come across. And I think parents can coach kids through this a little bit.
Right.
But that was a lesson to me because I've used it with other kids frequently. Pay attention to how people respond to you because it may not be perfect and there might be an adjustment you want to make, and it can be a minor adjustment that gets you in the fold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good advice. And when the kid says, I'm a little different, how do I fix that? It's okay to be different too, though, isn't it?
It's never been more okay to be different.
You're right.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, I think there is kind of this groundswell of support for kids who are weird, you know, like to the point where a number of kids have showed up in my office with weird is good t-shirts. You know what I mean? Like literally going out of their way to be a little off the beaten path to the point where I think convention is a little devalued a little bit. You know, I think it's, I think there is a lot of social credibility and power in being a little different than other kids. So I think that actually plays really, really well these days, whereas a generation ago, that might have been the subject of bullying.
When we were growing up, I mean, I was talking about all wore like landlubber bib top skirts the same day. We all had candy slip-on shoes because we wanted to be part of a group and you didn't want to stand out and be different. And I get mad at myself for going, you know, there are several kids I know now that were those different kids and I may not have thought they were cool then, but now I totally do.
Yeah.
Because they've always marched to the beat of their own drum.
Right, right. And I think those kids now have other kids' attention, you know, like those kids who are have the confidence, I think, to create and listen to themselves and march to the beat of their own drum. Well put.
It's interesting to me, as I've gotten older, to watch the kids that were kind of the lone wolves or just separate from everybody else to the direction that they've taken. And sometimes I follow them on Facebook or I would run into them at reunions, you know, 10, 15, 20-year reunions.
Right.
And some of them really blossomed in college or afterwards. And some of them are kind of the same version of what they were when they were kids. There's no exact route that they've taken. They've kind of just run the gamut.
Right. And I think that's probably true. Just human nature that,
yeah,
you know,
we're
imagine. All a little bit different. But it kind of suggests like you can't make too many assumptions about people. And you're reminding me of a girl I worked with recently who you would think was the most popular 17-year-old kid on earth.
Yeah.
And she's alone all the time. And she's like, you know, well, yeah, boys are kind of nervous to talk to me and girls don't really like me a whole lot because they think I'm popular with boys. And so, you know, I'm home
by herself
alone a lot, you know. So
does that bother her?
It bothers her. Yeah.
It's
the bane of her existence. It makes her anxious. It makes her depressed quite a bit. And yet she puts on this face that makes it look as if she's got it all put together, you know.
So what do you say to her in a case like that? How does that get fixed?
To allow herself to be a little more open and vulnerable with other kids. You know what I mean? And known, you know, part of it is that she's created this image via how she presents herself at school, via Instagram and, you know, and Facebook that looks invulnerable. And I think that's not particularly approachable.
Right.
Whereas if she lets people know, like, boy, you know, I really don't have anything going on this weekend. I would love to get together with you guys.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes that little inroad is all it takes. And the people she asks might and often are kind of like, oh, we had no idea. We thought you were busy, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's so awkward. It is. I want to go shopping with Kristen Decker, and I don't know how to ask her, but now I just did on the radio. So now it's okay. But to do a one-on-one thing, like I can say anything on the radio, but one-on-one, my intimate relationships might be a little lag.
Then always use the airwaves.
Yeah, I guess I will.
It's a great way to ask somebody out.
Yeah.
Keanu Reeves, if you're listening, The Available Parent is the name of this book that I really refer to. It's, to me, like the parent's Bible.
Oh, thank you.
You can really get a lot of help. He's a clinical psychologist. He's a life coach. He's a parent himself, a proud husband. Dr. John Duffy, you can reach him at drjohnduffy.com. And we can listen to his podcast. Is it called anything in particular?
It's the steering committee got together and called it the Dr. John Duffy Podcast.
That's a great name.
I like it.
That's a great name, John.
And you can be looking for that in the next week at WGNplus.com. Thank you for coming up.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, John. We'll take a quick break and then the news with Kim Gordon. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
I had this at my wedding when I walked down the aisle.
Right. I remember. I remember somebody ran up and handed you a torch and then you ran to the front of the church.
And Jim blew it out and ruined the whole party.
What was he thinking? You don't
I
blow
love
out
that
an Olympic
music.
Torch. It's very majestic sounding. Very majestic.
I'm pretty excited about the Olympics, except for there may not be a lot of participants.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Let's say, this is hypothetical, as far as I know. Let's say you were on the Olympic team.
What team am I on?
Team USA.
For what event?
Shot put.
You're an ass.
Why? That's a legitimate event. That's a legitimate event, the shot put. And shot
so
put is one of those
me,
sports
Kevin.
That
what
isn't...
What is up?
Shot put is...
It's not the meanest
not
thing
mean.
You
have you seen the women who do the shot put? Thank you.
They're attractive.
Shut
women.
Your little face.
They're attractive. Shot put is one of those sports that isn't just popular during the Olympics. Shot put's always popular. People love shot put.
I'm going shot putting this weekend.
Everybody shot puts. So let's say you were on that team. And
no,
also,
let's not.
Also, you pick your event. What do you want
Forget
to be
it.
In? And any other event of your choice.
My fun.
And the Olympics are coming in like 2 months. and you know what you know about what's going on in Rio. You know the water is, it's like fire.
I know.
Like when you turn on your sink in Rio, fire comes out instead of water.
It's the devil's water.
So there's that. There's the Zika virus.
Oh, yeah, there's that.
Which is bad also. Whether you do or do not shot put, you're susceptible to the Zika virus. And all the things going on, a lot of the venues aren't even close to being built yet.
I know. Did they know that the Olympics starts in 2 months?
They got a flyer saying, we got the Summer Olympics, have them ready.
Where was it last Summer Olympics that, remember, at the last minute things weren't...
Almost all Olympics. There's always finished. Stuff... Well, you probably mean Sochi.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So that one was a mess. Although...
They pulled it off.
They got it up. Yeah. But if you look at any of the Olympics over the last, I don't know how many years, it always comes down to the last minute before things are corrected. Here's the question. Would you go, if you were on the Olympic team for whatever sport, would you go knowing what you know about what's going on in Rio right now?
At this age, first of all, that'd be amazing if I was a shot putter at this age.
Yeah.
I would, because I'm not worried about having children, and it affects, you know, people who are pregnant.
Right.
And in the first trimester, and I don't, there was some, was it a baseball player that just came out that said he had the Zika virus?
Yes.
And was feeling like hell.
He
but
said
you're not,
two awful weeks.
Yeah, but you're not going to die from it.
Right.
I think if I made an Olympic team, yeah, I think I'd
you
go.
You still would? I wouldn't go. Everything I hear about it, especially the water sports, the sports where you're in the water, the more I hear about it, the more I say to myself, yeah, it would be an honor and a privilege to be on the Olympic team, but your overall health is more important than being on the Olympic team.
Yeah,
I don't think I'd go.
What is Zika going to do to you? It's like a flu. You're going to feel bad for a while, but you've worked and earned this opportunity to go to the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
I don't know, but see, then I don't know how it's transferred, because now I'm hearing it's sexually transmitted. So if a guy goes and gets it and then is with a girl who's going to have a baby,
right.
I don't understand how it works.
All right. There were a couple of sources that said that they still weren't positive about the incubation period for the Zika virus. But then we had Dr. Morita on with us last week or 2 weeks ago, and she said that they have determined the exact amount of time. But then I did some research afterwards, and I'm reading conflicting things. So just out of playing it cautious, I'd be so afraid to go. Again, what an incredible honor to make your Olympic team. But if you think about the long-term effects of going over there right now.
But is it long-term? I guess I don't know. I guess
still
they
unanswered.
Don't know.
Yeah, it's still unanswered.
Because I'm hearing about it, and I'm not, you know me, I'm kind of panicky about germs and stuff.
Right.
But I'm not worried about this because I've already had my kids.
Yeah.
If you get it, to me, it's like the flu. You feel terrible for a while, but then it runs its course and it doesn't stay with you forever. Or does it?
Right. Well,
that's what I mean. They don't know
enough. Depends on who you ask. I know.
Who is the baseball player? You heard it this morning, too.
Yeah, I can't remember. I heard it last night, and I can't remember. I can't remember the player's name,
but he said
it's an awful couple of weeks.
And he went on to say, you better think about going to the Olympics,
because
I wouldn't.
Right. And several athletes across the spectrum from various sports have said they're still debating back and forth. I wondered, depending on what happens over the next month or two, when did the Olympics start? Is it late July, early August? Does that sound right? It's somewhere toward the end of summer. I wonder what will happen if more and more athletes start pulling out. You know,
well, and that I just say I am so 100% glad we didn't get it here.
I am too.
I didn't want it, and my main fear was terrorism. Seriously, you're opening up the floodgates for everyone in the world to come in. Somebody's going to squeak by and maybe pose as an athlete. Honest to God, that's why I didn't want it.
It is without a doubt. It's a huge security risk having the Olympics. I have friends who have explained to me how the city would benefit tremendously from having the Olympics, but there's so many. It was almost unpatriotic when we were in that competition to whether or not we would get them, and Rio got them. The city was really so sad that we didn't get them, and I felt guilty that I wasn't sad.
I was relieved. I totally was. Rio Olympic Games 2016 summer begins Friday, August 5th, runs through Sunday, August 21st, and despite the arrival of the Zika virus there, that water, to be in the water sports, I don't know about.
Right.
How could they have won?
I don't know. I don't know.
How can you subject these athletes to these conditions?
Well, Rio looks, like on paper, Rio looks perfect. It
even
looks
in the
beautiful.
Commercials.
Doesn't it?
That it statue?
Yeah, that giant statue, yeah. The religious statue. Every time I've seen Rio, ever since I was a kid, it always looks like a James Bond set. You know, it's the beaches are stunning.
Yep.
It looks gorgeous. And even when they got it, you go, well, you could see why Rio would get it. Look at how glamorous Rio looks. But then the more we got to know about it, what was going on behind the scenes, the more you go, wait a minute, how did they get it? What was going on? Has the water of Rio always been as bad as it is now?
I don't believe so.
That's a new development, right? It's
yes,
gotta be.
We got the TSA lines, they got the water
right.
problems.
That's how we divvied it up. I know. How would the fact that we have no budget in the state have played into the Olympics? Because they would have to have allocated various kinds of funds for buildings and things. So with us not having any sort of a budget, how would that have played out if we had had the Olympics this year?
Great question.
You know, Brazil's not really better off. I mean, they're not really wealthy and they lack a president at the moment.
Right.
So things aren't going well.
So how did they win it? How did they win the bid for the Summer Olympics?
I don't know.
Did they have a president back then? I don't keep track of
these
things.
Yeah, they did then.
A relatively new
president. Yeah, she just got impeached.
Oh, that's right.
Happened a few weeks ago, right?
Yeah, but still, if the water problem was there before, it must not have been there when they won the bid, although I seem to remember people talking about that.
I'm trying to remember back, because that process, when we were one of the finalists, was that 4 years ago? Was that 3 years ago or 4 years ago? Something like that, right?
Well, yeah, because it's every 4 years.
No, it must have been longer ago than that.
I think it was almost like 6 or 8 years ago, because I remember our newsroom when that all went happened was still on the first floor.
Right.
And so, because you have to prepare in advance. So
yeah.
I feel like it was like, and Mayor Daley was obviously the mayor at the time.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, he would have been.
Yeah. So it's
right, closer
be,
to 6 to 8
yeah.
years ago. Right.
Dig this text from 630. My husband was in Brazil end of this past October. He doesn't see how any way possible they're going to pull this off. He said the water is dangerous.
Oh, great.
I mean, how can they put athletes in harm's way? Are they going to build pools to get them?
Well, yeah, there's some of the events will lend themselves to pools,
right.
But then there's all kinds of events.
They can't do it in the water.
Right. Any of the ones, what's the one where you're rowing backwards? What's that called? It's not called rowing backwards. They have a more Olympic sounding name for it.
Crew?
Crewing, right. That's what, there's several events that take place where you need a lake. You need some sort of body of water.
That's like them coming here and doing it in the Chicago River.
Right.
Well, that might be a little worse.
And then an athlete falls in the water. He looks like Deadpool. Nobody wants that.
Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Sean Butter and non-believer. How you doing?
Fine, Dave. What are your thoughts on this?
The water situation in Rio de Janeiro has been that way all along. Their raw sewage dumped straight into the river going into the ocean. They were going to clean it up, make sure it was clean. That hasn't happened.
So how did they?
As far as I'm getting, go ahead.
How did they secure this with that being common knowledge? How were they able to pull this off over cities that didn't have a water problem?
Wasn't there a Broadway show that the song was "Promises, Promises, Promises"?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what they did.
They said we'll have this fixed for sure by the time the Olympics are here, and then they didn't.
Well, they were going to clear slums. They were going to do all sorts of wonderful things for the communities, et cetera. And the Olympic Committee went, oh, that sounds good. Let's do that.
It was announced earlier this year in February that funding problems was the reason they could not clean out Rio's polluted waterways.
Right.
That's a big oops.
Of course. Well, you know, Trump says the same thing. We're going to do this, and look what we got, you know.
Dave, if you were on the Olympic team with Wendy, on the shot put team, the U.S. shot put team, would you be going to the Rio Olympics?
I'd be going to see the shot putters. And hey, Billy, I want to see those hammer throwers. They're gorgeous.
Hi, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. Dave turned into Mr. Magoo at the end.
He had a gas leak in his car. I think that's what happened.
That happens.
Austin.
Hi, how's it going? My name's Austin. I've been.
Hi, I'm Wendy.
Brazil.
This is Bill.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, my name's Austin. I've been to Brazil about 6 times, and I think there's plenty of other reasons not to support the Olympics other than the water. And there's been several groups of natives that have been displaced to break ground for Olympic facilities.
So by displaced, what exactly do they do with the natives in those cases?
They were forcibly moved by Brazilian federal police.
Yeah.
And I don't know what situation was provided to them. Probably nothing.
And it's not like they were given money for their land or their house or something. They were just pretty much kicked out.
Right. And there have been facilities that have been built next to some of the largest slums in the world. I don't know the geography of where the Olympics are, but there was a huge favela in Rio where several hundred people were displaced in order to make way for the Olympics.
But to boycott it now, Austin, the damage has already been done to these people in their villages.
Yeah, I think that Brazil is a great place to go apart from the Olympics. And I've often said that the current model for the Olympics is quite unsustainable. I think that we need to have a winter and summer location that's built and fixed and that the world community of sports donates to and helps maintain through the years, and perhaps a country hosts and volunteers its help one particular year, and maybe it's themed as Brazil or themed as something.
That's an interesting idea, like just a set location that you keep coming back to.
Oh, the same place every time, you mean?
But
oh,
then
that's
different host countries will, like, it'll be Brazil's year, maybe. Oh. That's kind of an interesting idea, Austin.
Yeah, but I don't think the model that we currently use makes sense to be building these huge facilities that these countries have to use. And another thing in Brazil, for the World Cup, there's a city in northern Brazil in the middle of the Amazon that they built a quarter of a million seating for the World Cup. And now it's used for public bus storage because none of the teams there have fandoms big enough just to fill the stadium.
That's so wasteful.
So it's just not sustainable. Yeah.
Thanks, Austin. Thank you. Even when we were in the running, when Chicago was in the running, despite the fact that we have major sports venues, they were saying that more than likely, had we gotten it, this was during the time, we would have to build at least one and maybe two even bigger stadiums for soccer and other sports.
Yep.
And then everyone was saying, well, then once it's over, what will we do with those? And nobody had an answer for that.
And what are they doing in Sochi? What are they doing with the stuff that they built?
I don't know.
That seems so wasteful.
Yeah.
I like the set place.
That's a great idea. I never heard of that before.
Although who would win it, but you'd have to, you know, vie for it and try and get the position. And then each year a different country would host it.
Yeah.
There'd be like this year would be a Brazilian flair to it.
Right.
I think that's a great idea.
That's interesting, isn't it? All right. More on this and other topics. If you'd like to jump in, we'd love to hear from you. We're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
We're talking Summer Olympics and, boy, the fear of attending it in Rio de Janeiro because of the Zika virus, because of the filthy water. And Austin called in with an idea I really hadn't thought of or heard of before, a set location where you keep upkeeping that particular Olympic arena or Olympic village mm-hmm. in one central location. I don't know how we'd decide on that, but Karen, you like that idea?
I love that idea because there's always a political reason not to go somewhere. I mean, what about the human rights issues in China? And they had them there. What about the human rights issues in Russia? I mean, it's just perfect for people to have a reason not to go because you can always find a country that's going to have something going on. Brazil is horrible. I've been there three times and I refuse to go back because right off that main strip, which is like our Oak Street Beach, it's yeah. like the continuum of beaches, Ipanema and et cetera. I mean, but as soon as you leave the Gold Coast, there's nothing. It's much worse than Cabrini Green was.
Wow.
It was death. I mean, it is a dump. I mean, you see little kids drinking out of open sewage, I mean, and ugh. Playing in dirt. I mean, with, you know, babies with no diapers. It's just a mess. And I was shocked when Chicago didn't get it. That had to be all a political move by the people who were on that committee because all that stuff was there way before they chose Rio.
Thank you.
I think it's an excellent idea.
Thank you, Karen. And very quickly, Neil wants to put the other side of that argument out there. Hi, Neil. We only have about a minute.
Hey, kid. So the problem with that is the whole city gets so much money pumped into their economy from hotels to restaurants to whores.
all of that money comes in from other countries into the host city. So that's why all the various places. True.
But, Neil, I always hear stories about how the cities that host the Olympics, winter and summer, always talk about the boom to the economy. But then they always come back a year or so later and say it was nowhere near what we thought. And several of them operated a tremendous loss.
And the Sochi Olympic Village has been left desolate. It says
it's a ghost town.
$51 billion ghetto. Extraordinary images show Vladimir Putin's Sochi Olympic Park just lies desolate and abandoned 1 year after the most expensive games in history.
I do wonder how much of that is like Hollywood accounting, though.
Could be, but the article Wendy's referring to, and I have found three that show all these abandoned structures. I don't know, it wouldn't be in Russia's best interest to let out information like this, pictures like this, or stories like this if they weren't true, right? I mean, I know what you mean about Hollywood accounting, that somebody made money, and they do, but the promise of all these things living on and being viable options for the city, more times than not, that just doesn't pan out.
Yeah, so maybe it's just a short-term influx of cash that comes in from all the visitors.
Sure. Oh, I'm positive. That has to be the case. Neil, we have to run, though. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Ball.
Take care.
Friend of yours?
Everyone's a friend of mine, Wendy. The world is my friend. Steve is in studio and will tell us what he has coming up on the Wintrust Business Lunch in just a little bit. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Bill, you know what they say.
What do they say again? Remind me.
You gotta keep them separated.
Well, you have to keep them separated. There's no debating that. Hi, we have two shows. This is our second one. We're thrilled that you're listening. We're 312-981-7200. I'm Bill. That's Wendy. Kim Gordon reported a story in the news that we're all watching, especially in the newsroom, and that's the shooting story in UCLA. Kim, as of now, as of this moment, it's still a live crime scene, correct?
It definitely is a live crime scene. And right now, the Los Angeles police are saying that they have confirmed two people dead in this UCLA shooting. No, I'm sorry. They have not confirmed two people dead. There are two victims. We are getting, you know, this is all kind of coming in. And so we're trying to keep it all as up to date as we possibly can. So there are two victims. We don't know the status of their conditions at this point. We believe that this happened in an engineering building on the campus. The campus still remains on lockdown, and police say they just don't have a lot of information to go on at this point.
That is scary that the person of interest is still out there.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, they say the city of L.A. says that they have the whole city on a tactical alert.
Do you know what that means when you hear that? What does that mean exactly, a tactical alert?
They're out and about, and they're ready to go into action if necessary. Because you don't know if that person is still on campus. I mean, that's what's so freaky about this.
I know.
And it can happen anywhere, UCLA, in the engineering building.
Right. With probably, I'm just guessing here, but they probably have another week or two of school to go.
I mean, they're out.
There's never, do you think they would be out?
Most of the college kids, at least in our area, are already out of school.
So we, at this point, nobody knows exactly what led to this or why we are where we are in this story.
No, I think there's a lot of unanswered questions right now.
It's terrible. What do you think about this? I've thought about this in the past, but every time there is a shooting of this magnitude, I think about something like this. What if there was a presidential candidate that ran on the platform of, if I'm president of the United States...
But let me just clarify what this tactical alert is, because I don't want to scare people. But apparently it's just a way they're saying that it's a bad name for what they do. We don't want to scare people. So basically what it does, it's a way for them to allocate resources so they can make sure that they have enough people out there to be able to investigate the scene.
So it's not like you're going to see armed guards with shields walking down the street.
All right.
But I'm sure they're driving around looking up and down the street and ready to pounce if necessary.
Yeah, you'd imagine. All right. So whenever there's a story like this, and sadly it happens way, way, way too frequently, you get one side saying this is why you just can't have guns, or you got to do something about the guns because they're way too easy to get. And then you couple the guns with any kind of mental illness and it's a cocktail that always ends in disaster. So that's on one side. On the other side, you get people who go, no, this country was built on the fact that we need to have guns. And if you want a gun, you got to have access to a gun. And that's why we're America. Okay. So somewhere in the middle, I guess, lies the truth. What if there was a presidential candidate who said, hey, look, we've tried this for a long time, And the gun thing just doesn't seem to be working. We've tried as a society to give the guns to the people who need them, but unfortunately, too many bad people got them. So if I'm the president, I'm saying guns are illegal. That's my platform.
That'll never happen.
That's what I was going to say. That man or woman wouldn't stand any kind of a chance, would they?
And again, I don't choose to have a gun. I don't really care if other people have guns because they've had guns forever. And if you're a responsible gun owner, you go through the proper channels and you have a gun and that's your own business. Hopefully you don't shoot me with it. These people, you know, get the guns through legal ways and manage to get them. I don't even understand. The guns are getting into the hands of the wrong people, but not necessarily illegally.
Are we all in agreement that if somebody wants to get a gun at this point,
yep,
they can get a gun, right?
Yeah.
And you can put as many restrictions on the guns as you want. You can try to make it as difficult as you possibly want. I don't have a gun license. If I wanted to get a gun, I know for a fact I could get a gun. There's no doubt in my mind.
But
I could get a gun.
I mean, I don't really worry about you having a gun.
No, me, but I'm just saying I'm just one of countless people that if I have access, if I know somebody, I know a couple people, I know where they keep their guns. If I wanted to, I could very cleverly get that gun. Anyone can get a gun.
Right. So outlawing guns doesn't make it, I mean.
Right. It just, basically, we're lying to ourselves as a society saying we can put all these restrictions in place. And yeah, we can make it a little bit harder to get a gun. But the bottom line is, if somebody wants to get a gun, they always say that about your house, too. You put up the best security system you want. If somebody wants to break into your house, they're going to break into your house. It's kind of the same way with a gun, isn't it?
Yeah.
If somebody has their heart set on doing something and needs a gun, they're going to find a way to get one.
The reason I don't like guns in our house is because there's no taking back a bullet. If you get in a fight and you're mad at somebody, look at the actor from The Shield.
The guy who killed his wife.
Michael Jace, I believe is his name. I know this happened a few years ago and it just came to trial and he was found guilty.
Yeah.
You know, he was mad at his wife. He assumed that she was having an affair. It's one thing, and I'm not condoning this, but it's one thing to yell at her or even hit her. But when you shoot her, there's no turning back.
That's it.
And he was probably a registered gun owner. I just don't like the temptation.
To do harm to somebody else,
yeah.
To do harm to yourself.
I know, because you know what? In this, during the recession, people who had guns,
right.
I had friends who, a friend and a family who had guns during the recession, didn't think there was light at the end of the tunnel and used it.
Yeah.
If you didn't have it, you know, maybe there are other ways to do it. That's why I don't want a gun. I don't care if anybody else has a gun, if they go through the proper channels and do it the right way. I'm not worried about those people shooting me. I'm worried about people getting those guns who aren't supposed to have a gun and who are going to use it to kill somebody.
Right.
Which is what's going on in Chicago. It's not registered gun owners.
I know. All right, we're getting calls on it, and we welcome those calls at 312-981-7200. We've brought up a couple of ideas. What are your thoughts on them? Again, 312-981-7200. You can call us or text us.
We're talking about the active shooter situation at UCLA in California at the engineering building. A couple of clarifications. Michael Jace from The Shield was not a registered gun owner, evidently. He took the gun from his wife's father.
Hmm.
Which, again, proves your point. If someone wants to get a gun, they're going to get a gun.
You find a way, yeah.
And let's get some calls in here. I don't know what you posed as an option to this, and I don't know if anybody knows what's right. You can restrict gun laws. That's not going to make a difference in a situation like this, is it?
No, I think we are fooling ourselves. I would love to see tighter restrictions, but ultimately, and this is sad, it's tragic to say this, I don't think it matters. I just think if somebody's bent on doing something with a gun, they're going to find a way to get a gun and do what they want.
Legally or not.
Yeah.
I agree with you. Hi, Rich.
Oh, hi. Part of the problem you mentioned, the mix of guns and mental illness, is especially with HIPAA laws, is people that are being treated for a condition where mentally they pose a threat to themselves or others, it's not reported to the police. And the reason why I know this, a friend of mine owned a sporting goods store in Florida, and he sold guns. He sold a gun to a gentleman, did what he was supposed to, did the background check through the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Gentleman picked up his gun, went home, shot himself.
Hmm.
And my friend got sued out of business, had to sell his boat, some of his cars. because they said he should have known the man was mentally unstable.
But how could he have known that? How could he have known that? You're right about the HIPAA laws.
Why did this guy pass the background check? Even though on the form it says, are you being treated for mental illness, blah, blah, blah.
Who's going to say yes if they're trying to get a gun?
The guy was sane enough to check no to that box that he wasn't being treated. But the trouble is, in my opinion, there should be a law that a doctor, a psychiatrist should have a responsibility to say, listen, this man's a threat to himself and others, and he should be able to report it to the police. And we keep hearing, oh, there's the stigma of mental illness. I'm not saying put the guy's name and face on a billboard on the highway.
Right.
But the law, the proper law enforcement authorities should know that this person poses a threat. So that way, when they go to apply for a gun card in Illinois or in states that they don't have a gun card, just to buy a gun, when that form is submitted to law enforcement for the background check, it gets stamped with a nice big red denied. But right now, people of that condition are not reported to the police. So they go to buy a gun, they pass the background check, and we see this happen time and time again.
I didn't even think about the HIPAA laws where you can't disclose any medical treatment of any kind. You're absolutely right. So how does it even work when you try to get a gun?
Well, as he said, the whole screening process, Rich, is them asking you, are you suffering from any mental illness? So, you check the wrong box.
And you lie, and because the police don't know about it, you pass the check.
Shouldn't be that way.
How do you solve that problem?
I don't know.
We need to change the laws. Not so much adding new laws, but let's start enforcing the ones that are on the books. And I'm sorry, if you're buying a gun, you might say, the stigma of mental illness, this, that, whatever. Sometimes you need to have a little bit of your privacy invaded if you want to enjoy your freedoms.
Agreed.
I agree.
They should know who you are. And like I said, if you're the type of person who's been diagnosed that you're a threat to society, law enforcement should know it. I know it's a medical condition, and they say, we have our right to privacy. Not in that case, pal.
But it's a medical condition that we're all affected by. Unfortunately, it can be incredibly negatively. So I just think.
But even somebody who doesn't have any kind of mental illness or issues at all, no depression, no anxiety, can still obtain a gun and have a breakdown any previous medical, emotional.
This is true.
So, right. I mean, I just don't know what the answer is. Rich, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
This is crazy. Hi, Vic.
Hey, you were talking about making guns illegal. Drugs are illegal. Look where that's getting us in this country.
Kind of a different situation.
Well,
you're not going to shoot anyone with a joint.
No,
but just think all the money that's coming in from the drugs, and that's fueling all the gang wars and everything else.
Well, marijuana's on the books to become legal here pretty soon.
I'm just saying, you can't just make a clean sweep and just saying guns are illegal. It's
so,
not going to work.
Vic,
there'll be more guns out there than ever.
Probably.
Vic, answer if you could really quickly. I threw out a scenario. Let's say there's a political candidate that says, look, our society tried it for a long time. We said if you want to get a gun, apply for a gun and we'll give you a gun. And it failed. It failed miserably. So my platform is, this politician says, no guns. We tried it. It didn't work. You got a gun. Not going to work. That guy wouldn't stand a chance, would he?
No, not at all. Not based on a Second Amendment in this country that our forefathers worked so hard for and that this country's been based upon for centuries.
Yeah.
But our forefathers had to use the guns in duels and protecting
their
land.
They had to load up muskets. They didn't have rapid-fire machine guns.
It is a little different, but I hear your point, Vic. Thank you for chiming in.
Thank you.
The law says, according to a texter, 630, doctors must report people who are a danger to themselves or others.
And who gets that report, though? Like in this case, Rich called up and said his friend sold a gun. Did he have access to this? How would he have obtained that knowledge?
Is there some kind of database that they have?
There should be.
Yeah.
There should be. But again, if you're that guy and you try to buy a gun and you don't, and they deny you, and that guy has some sort of a seed in his head that I need to have a gun, he'll find a way to get the gun.
Absolutely. And statistics, according to this caller, which I don't know is factual, but it sure sounds accurate, 630 says mentally ill people account for less than 5% of shootings nationwide. I kind of
even at that number, and again, I don't have the information in front of me. Let's say that's true. Let's say it's 5%. That's still huge. That's gigantic. Even if it's 5%, that's way too much.
Of people who have mental illness that use a gun?
That are using, yeah, that's huge.
But that means more people who don't have mental issues are killing people.
Right, which is also a problem.
I know.
I mean, no matter how you slice it, the fact that somebody's having a bad day, a horrendous day, and decides to go to a school or a movie theater or wherever and just start shooting at people, you gotta find a way. I mean, everybody talks about it, but nobody does anything about it.
And aren't there metal detectors and stuff at schools
now?
Yeah,
there's metal detectors everywhere now. So, and there's stickers on doors that say you can't bring your weapon in. And
yeah, but metal detectors, if someone's walking in the school, you'd think the alarm would go off.
Right. Yeah, I don't know how UCLA is situated in terms of that sort of thing. So.
Well, we'll continue to follow this. Steve Bertrand's back in the newsroom, and everybody up in the newsroom is following this, and we'll report it as it develops, and hopefully they'll find the perpetrator who is at this point still on the loose. It's Bill Leffens.
Well, we don't know that. I don't mean to jump in
there. No, you should.
Right. I mean, I don't think police have said that they're looking for a shooter yet. I mean, you know, a lot of times one of the victims is actually the shooter, so we don't know that they're looking for someone.
So this is just pretty fresh. When did this happen? Like within the last hour?
About an hour or so ago, I think Kim started talking about it, yeah.
All right, well, we'll stay on that, and we'll keep you abreast of the situation. It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder at 720 WGN. We're probably going to continue this conversation for the next year because we're never going to come to a conclusion on how you prevent gun mishaps.
You know, we've discussed this in the past. For people who don't know, we're in another situation at UCLA on campus, the engineering building. All the details are still coming in. We're going to talk to Alex Stone later in the show from ABC News, who is there at the scene. He'll be on with us later on in the show. But you don't want to become numb to this. As many times as you hear these stories, and like I said, they're way, way, way too frequent, something's wrong if you become numb to it. And you try to figure out what we as a society can possibly do differently. And I don't know what we can do because it's so random and it's a mixture of guns and sometimes mental illness. And it's impossible to predict where and when. So realistically, what can you do?
And I don't know who has become numb to this. I mean, every time I hear this, I start worrying about my kids in schools.
Oh, sure.
When we went to school, that was honestly, I feel like Mrs. Eggleston, my kindergarten teacher, would have thrown herself in front of anyone to protect that class.
Yeah.
And she didn't have to. Now, I know teachers would do the best that they can, and they have plans and strategies, but are our kids safe in school anymore? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Justin wants to talk. He's been on hold for a while. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Wendy. How are you?
Excellent. Good. Sad about what's going on, but other than that, fine. What's on your mind?
Well, I just kind of wanted to step back to what you said about making the weapons illegal.
Bill said that. And he didn't
follow. Yeah.
If there's a candidate.
Follow laws.
Go ahead.
I was just kind of trying to put that out there. If you're going to make it illegal, they're already breaking laws with what they're doing.
Sure.
They're already willing to find them one way or another if they're getting them illegally. So making them totally illegal, what's to say they're not going to find a way to ship them in?
Yeah.
I think there's probably a better solution to it than totally outlawing the weapons. I don't have that out there. I'm just pointing out that if they're wanting to do it, they're going to find a way.
Do you think most people would agree with this sentence? More bad comes from guns than good. Do you think most people would agree to that?
I don't know if most would agree. There are plenty of people on either sides of the debate. I personally have my own that I use just for target shooting and something to do on the weekends, but I never have any real purpose behind it.
But for the safety of society, as much as you enjoy target shooting, if somebody said, if there was an edict nationwide that said, look, I know a lot of you are using goods for good. Unfortunately, there's so many people using them for bad that we have to do something about it. And that thing is, you all have to turn them in. And this is hypothetical. I know people will panic and go, no, there's an amendment that says you can't do this. I know you enjoy target shooting, but for the good of society, if they took away your gun and said, look, realistically, there's too many people doing bad things and we have to take them away, would you be okay with that or not?
I wouldn't be okay with that,
no. I would have a problem with it, but...
Because people would still have them, people who are bad.
I'd like to consider myself a law-abiding citizen.
But, and you said, and Bill's right, can you say... What has ever been done good by a gun? More bad than good has been done. Target practice is indifferent. It's not really good. You're not saving someone's life.
It's not good nor bad.
Right. But so what, just help us understand what good thing could be done by a gun.
I guess going back to what a lot of people use as a defense is it is, you know, a way to defend themselves in case it is needed, but I mean, I haven't personally needed that, so I can't really give a good and honest opinion about it because I've never been in a situation where I need a weapon to defend myself.
Thank God.
So, as far as it goes, I just think that there's probably a better way to monitor or, you know, figure out how to get it out of the wrong person's hands or a better vetting system as far as who is able to purchase them, if they have ties to anything criminal, and how they're going through everything.
Well, thank you for chiming in on this, Justin. We appreciate it.
Thank you for letting me speak my mind, and I hope you guys have a rest of the day. It was wonderful and hopefully not bad weather over there.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks very much. Listener Bill has an opinion, and we want to listen to it. Hi, Bill.
Hi, guys. I have a question on the statistical side. Has anybody ever done a study to see what percentage of shootings are done by illegal guns, by illegal owners?
I'm sure those numbers are out there somewhere. They'd have to be.
In my opinion, it's going to be the by far the greater percentage. And then when you look at that, I would say that what we need to be doing with regard to gun laws and enforcement is finding the way that the illegal guns are getting into people's hands and stop that rather than outlaw them, because if your percentage of people that are using their guns in legal ways, whether it's target shooting, hunting, you know, then they shouldn't have to give up their guns when it's mostly illegal people.
But, Bill, don't you think, and I mentioned this earlier, don't you think it's just such a temporary bandage that even though you can make those laws as strict as you want to make them, if somebody decides, I need to get a gun and do something horrendous with it, if somebody's got that mindset, they'll figure out a way to get that done, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. The only thing is, what I'm saying is not necessarily more laws, but find ways to stop the flow of the guns getting into illegal hands.
Yeah.
In most cases, you'd be able to do that. If I was going to go nuts and grab my dad's gun or something, you're not going to stop that.
Right.
But I think the larger percentage are people who actually have, you know, say gangs and stuff. They buy illegal guns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have throwaway guns.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of things that, when you hear that there was 28 shootings on the weekend, that was probably 25 of those done by gangs with drive-bys and illegal guns.
I don't know what this year's statistic was in 2016, but in 2015, on Black Friday, the FBI processed a record-setting 185,345 background checks to get guns. That was Black Friday of 2015. Excuse me, yes, 2015. I don't know about this past, you know, that had to have been last year. All right.
Last year, yeah.
2015. Gun sales in 2015 continued at a blistering pace.
Oh, record-setting because everybody was so sure that with all that's going on that the government was going to mandate that you can't get guns anymore, so everybody panicked and bought way, way more. Yeah.
Right, right.
Let's stock the arsenal here at WGN, Bill.
Bill, we appreciate the call. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Have a great day.
Take a break. More calls?
Yeah, plenty more calls. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200, call us or text us. We'll get to those in just a minute. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
We're talking gun violence. I went to thetrace.org, not sure of the website, but at a rate of more than twice a day, someone under 18 has been shot and killed. These are statistics from 2015. Mm-hmm. At least 756 American children have been killed by gunfire in 2015.
Yeah, the numbers are staggering. It's all kinds of sad. And really, we can talk about it. You can talk about it all day, every day. I don't know how you fix it. There's just no way to fix it.
And for people who do have legal guns in their house, if they're unsecured, in 2015, on average, a toddler in America shoots someone about once a week.
Yeah, there have been a couple stories like that. And you say to yourself, aside from that child no longer being around, if you're the parents of that kid or
if you're the
family
one who
member,
did the shooting, you didn't mean for your little brother or sister to die.
Right. So, yeah, it's devastating, isn't it? All right, we're at 312-981-7200. Anxious to hear your thoughts and comments.
Hi, Sean.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Good. What are your thoughts? Good.
Well, you know, as a general theme of the afternoon that's being talked about is the banning of guns. Bill's kind of thrown that topic out a few times. And I think, my opinion, you could take and suck up every piece of firearm that's out there. And if somebody is bent on doing destruction to another individual, they will find a way to do it. Whether it's a gun, it could be a bow and arrow, it could be a rock, as far as that goes, if you ban everything that level.
It could be your own hands.
Yeah, exactly. You could strangle somebody, you could use a pocket mag, you could probably use a paper clip to kill somebody if you were trained the right way. The challenge that I see and what we don't want to talk about is of the people that are using guns or doing destructive activities to other people is what value of life, for life, do they have? And, I mean, it comes down to a simple moral compass that a person needs to have that points them between right and wrong. Now, if they want to play psychological events, but you start getting into a society now where you don't want to hold anybody accountable, that their psychiatric evaluation makes them biased to go one direction or another, and we can't blame them for what's wrong with them psychiatrically. We can't ban somebody from doing whatever they want because it's a mental issue, but yet we want to monitor it, engage people on how we allow them to have access to other things, but we don't want to ban them from going into a bathroom. So I don't know how we can have our cake and eat it too until we get to the grassroots of it, of having a strong moral compass as a society to where you value another person's life if you've got a problem with it. There's other ways to take care of it. Or if you're mad at a situation, the gun isn't the situation. It's the result of access and the fact that it's been glorified. And as quickly as we have promoted this incident today in UCLA, how much time did you guys really talk about the 52 or 54 individuals that were used guns in over the weekend in Chicago?
Not long enough.
We just take it as a matter of fact that it is what it is here and there, but now we've got a special situation, and it just comes down to, as a society, we have degraded to a point where those individuals that are doing these things for whatever reason, whether it's the way they are brought up, a lack of family orientation, lack of religion or church or morality, has broken down society where it's an acceptable way to behave.
But, Sean, if I may, if you look at countries that have banned guns, where you're just not allowed to have them, countries like England or Australia, their homicide rates are low, are incredibly low, like off the charts low across the board, not just guns. I know what you're saying. If you take guns away, people will use bottle openers or paper clips or buzz saws or whatever, but their homicide rate is just off the charts low. It's almost non-existent for anything. Their societies seem to be doing okay without the freedom of having a gun.
And how do they enforce that is my question. If guns were made illegal, how do you enforce that?
You go to jail if they find you have a gun.
because pot's illegal. You don't go to jail for smoking pot.
No, but it's considered to be a capital offense in those countries.
And that's how they keep it in check.
Yeah.
And I don't have an answer for you, Bill, on why in Europe or other countries they don't have a problem with. Maybe we just aren't aware of some of the other issues that are happening if it's not a gun used death.
Yeah.
I mean, there's people that die every day that don't make the news. This just happened to be in a public place.
Yeah, mass shootings take precedence over individual shootings, and there are too many deaths, period. But when a mass shooting is ongoing like it is right now, that does get press because it's not solved at this point.
Well, it's newsworthy, and that's the business that everybody listens to as they spend most of their day, either online or in a vehicle driving around, they're listening to radio. And so we have to be an aware society.
Absolutely.
But
Sean, we got to run.
No, thank you very much for letting me speak my piece.
Sure. Absolutely. Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so I mean, if they can, I would be cool with no guns being around. I just don't know how you enforce it. But you said if they're put in jail,
that's it.
Although there are so many people that break the law here that aren't in jail, and then people that don't do anything really bad and are incarcerated. Something's broken here, Bill.
A little bit, just a little. I know. Do we have time for another call or two? Are we okay? Or is it tight?
All right. 30 seconds for you, Terry.
Hey, Bill. Hey, Wendy.
Hi.
Hey. No, I just wanted a quick comment on where the other gentleman was saying regarding target practice, you know, just on the weekends and things like that. Well, I do the same thing, and I was just going to say, for the greater good, I mean, I wouldn't mind giving that up. It's just a hobby. I mean, I don't have to do it, you know.
But you enjoy it. I mean, Bill plays tennis. If, you know, balls were outlawed.
I swear to you, as much as I love tennis or pizza or Pop-Tarts or go down the line, anything I love, if somebody said, yeah, but we've got all these incidents where people are getting killed because of Pop-Tarts or pizza, or I'd go, then take them away. I'll hand them right over.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that big of a deal. And the other thing, too, is, like the other guy was saying, well, this is America. And I completely understand that. Well, America has great power, and they say, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
You know? And, I mean, that's a responsibility that Americans, well, just people in general, have to just, you know, understand.
Something has to happen, and I don't know what it is.
I know. It's tough. It is. It's really tough. But, yeah, just wanted a quick comment with you guys. That's all.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks, Terry. Appreciate it.
It's scary. I told you, you know, I'm sometimes scared sitting in my car going, is this the day I get shot? You don't know. It's happening on expressways. It's happening everywhere. It doesn't make me stay home and stay in a fetal position, but I'm telling you, it's something I think about at least once a day somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I know. All right. We so appreciate the calls and the texts. Thank you so much for those. We have to take a quick break. Steve has the news, and then we have a lot more show for you. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Do you know I just saw this band live in action?
The Zombies you saw?
I can't tell you how fantastic this band was.
Yeah, and it's some original members of the...
It is the original singer, Colin, I can't remember his last name, Lumforth or something.
Colin Lumforth?
Blue, I gotta look it up. But Rod Argent, do you remember that Hold Your Head Up?
Yes.
Woman, hold your head up.
Yes, the song dedicated to posture, right? Before that song, people would walk around town slumped over, and then that song, and people went, you know what? That guy's right. We should hold our head not just up, but up high.
I'm telling you, if a chiropractor does not jump on that ad campaign.
It's a good one.
Colin Blunstone.
Colin Blunstone. A Brit?
All Brits.
I was guessing, yeah.
Went to the Arcata Theater Sunday night, and Colin, his voice is like just
still
like it sounded
the
like the record.
That's hard to do.
And then Rod Argent did Hold Your Head Up, and I don't know whose doing this was. I'm blaming Ron Onesti, but everyone got a glow stick.
Oh.
And when he did the Hold Your Head Up, woman.
Everybody held them up.
Yes, it was pretty cool.
In unison.
It was very fun.
That's fantastic.
And
that's
you
really
got
good.
A bonus glow stick for the price of your ticket.
What's wrong with that?
It's a win-win.
That's excellent.
But there was a gentleman on the stage who was an old man who looked like Popeye's grandpa or dad. Was it
Popeye's
Pappy?
Dad was Poop Deck Pappy. Yes.
That's what he kind of looked like. And
I think that became his name later in life. It'd be weird to have a kid named Poop Duck Pappy. I think when he was older, they dubbed him that, I think.
Well, it was a fantastic show, and go to oshows.com to find all these classic rockers coming back. It was great. Steve, do you have some breaking news?
Yeah, I just want to let you know, as we indicated perhaps earlier, that the police now in L.A. are saying it looks as if this was a murder-suicide at UCLA. There had been reports of a suicide note found at the scene. The police chief, talking to reporters just moments ago, said there was something found at the scene that could well be that, but he says the campus is safe. They are in the process of lifting the lockdown there, and the indications are that this was a murder-suicide in Southern California.
Bad news for the people involved in the murder-suicide, but great news for everyone else who was in lockdown at the UCLA campus.
Yeah.
Why don't we take a break? And Alex Stone is live from UCLA. We'll talk to him and find out the latest. And Steve Bertrand, thanks for that update.
Thanks, Steve. So, break ahead and then more. It's us, Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Steve Bertrand, we are going to be talking to Alex Stone, ABC News correspondent, momentarily. He is live on the scene at UCLA. You did break in with some news, and what is the situation?
Well, they're lifting the lockdown now piece by piece as they try to, you know, keep some order there. But this shooting ordeal in Southern California at UCLA looks as if it was a murder-suicide. There had been some reporting early on that there was something that looked like a suicide note found at the scene. Police Chief Charlie Beck saying that that was indeed the case, although he didn't say that was exactly what they found. I don't want to tell you everything that Alex is going to tell you in a couple of minutes. He probably was just monitoring this briefing or was at the briefing from Chief Beck. But the bottom line of it all is that it looks as if the ordeal is over. Things are going to start returning to normal now at UCLA in the next several minutes or so. Two people were killed at the campus today.
Imagine being, you know, students on lockdown and hearing, you know, they're obviously going to tell you what had happened.
Yeah.
And just wondering, is it someone I knew? Is it my friend? Is it someone in one of my classes? Just a lot of fear and a lot of craziness at the scene.
Sure,
so I'm
course.
Glad lockdown is over.
I know it's strange to try to tackle a situation like this rationally, but I always wonder when something like this happens, what the benefit is of doing it in public. You know what I mean? And again, I know I'm trying to come at it from a rational point of view, but you would think if there was some sort of a quibble between the shooter and the person that they killed before killing themselves, what would the benefit in this be in doing it in a public place?
You know? Maybe they, you know, if you're hell-bent on taking somebody out, and they're at school, you're not going to wait till they come home.
Yeah,
you act on an impulse, unfortunately.
I guess so. Yeah.
Do we know the identity? I mean, not identity, but male or female, Steve?
Reported earlier that it was two men, two males. We don't know their identities yet or their relationship to each other or their relationship to the school, really. That has not been discussed yet.
Remember the one at one of the department stores? I think the department store across the street last year, late last year.
At Nordstrom.
It was at
Nordstrom. I do remember that.
When, was it a jealous ex-boyfriend or something came?
And she was working, at the cosmetic counter or something and just shot her point blank.
Yeah. I remember thinking it then, and I think it every time a story like this is, not that it makes it any better or worse to do it privately or in public, but I don't know what the added benefit is of doing it in public.
Alex Stone on the line with us. You can ask Alex Stone that question, Bill, because really, talking about why take it to a public place.
Hey guys, well, yeah, hard. The answer could be a million different reasons depending on why somebody carries something like this out. In front of me here right now, LAPD SWAT vehicles, one after another, heavily armored vehicles that a short time ago were racing in here to the scene with their lights and sirens going. They are now leaving this area. We've seen a big slowdown of the response here right now. No more sirens, no more cars that are coming flying in. I see a number of SWAT team members who are now taking their gear off, the vests and the helmets and the long guns across their chest, as now police have determined that this was a murder-suicide, likely at least a murder-suicide. They are continuing to search the buildings just in case, but they believe that they have evidence of a suicide note. And that both victims are male victims, or a suspect and victim are both down. They died on scene inside an office in the engineering building here.
Any idea if they were students or employees of the school?
No, police say they don't know at this point. That will come from the coroner sometime down the line, likely later today or tomorrow. But they don't know what their relationship was to the school here. And they're just trying to piece all of that together right now. Yeah, up until about 15, 20 minutes ago, this was still a very active response scene with cars streaming in as they tried to figure out what was going on.
How far was the lockdown, Alex? Where did it start and begin, approximately?
Well, it was a number of buildings here on campus where they told everybody to shelter in place. Yeah, UCLA is a very urban campus.
Yeah.
It's on the west side of L.A. There are high-rise buildings all around. If you're on a street, it seems like you're on a regular L.A. street, except there's campus buildings all around. So it's not going onto a campus like you would think of a traditional campus, which makes it, one, it helps because that means there are a lot of response assets in the area to respond very quickly. The FBI headquarters in L.A. is only two blocks away, but at the same time, it made it very difficult to get into this area because freeways were gridlocked and streets were gridlocked for response teams to get in.
Alex, I know that as you left for this assignment, there were a lot of unanswered questions. There's still several unanswered questions, but they were just trying to piece things together as you were on your way. How exactly do they determine what area is safe for you to be in a situation like this?
Well, they shut down what they can, and they shut down, in this case, a big perimeter. Now they think that the whole area is safe. There is no longer a threat to this area. And you can hear the police helicopters up above me here. They've got a no-fly zone for other helicopters in this area because they had so many law enforcement choppers and rescue choppers in the area that they didn't want to clog up the skies. But they do the best they can just shutting down streets, and that's what they did today, pushing back crowds to make sure that there is no threat to those in the immediate area.
ABC News correspondent Alex Stone on the line with us. As you mentioned, the two men were found in a small office in UCLA's engineering complex. Where was the suicide note found, alleged suicide note, and has that been released at this point? Was it in that office, just outside the office?
We don't know right now. Police say it was in the vicinity, that it was in the area, but they're not confirming exactly where it was found. They're calling it evidence of a suicide note, mm-hmm. that they think that it may be a suicide note. They're trying to confirm that right now. You know, with all of these, they try to be as careful as they can early on until they can confirm all the information.
Alex, am I imagining this? I've spent a bit of time in Los Angeles. It seems like Los Angeles is better equipped to have helicopters on the scene in cases like this than any other place in the country. Is that true, or am I just imagining that?
Well, you know, L.A. is a city that one, uses a lot of helicopters, and two, has a lot of resources. It's one of the biggest police departments in the country, biggest sheriff's department in the country as well. UCLA has its own police department. The FBI is right down the street. So there were a lot of resources. A lot of SWAT vehicles immediately came in. There are a number of command vehicles that are here as well, an FBI command vehicle parked that looks like a big RV that they're controlling some of the response. The ATF immediately came in. So those resources were right here to respond very quickly.
And have you spoken to any witnesses about the situation at hand? I mean, were other people not inside that small office in danger? Or what are witnesses saying about the scene?
Well, those who were in the building say that they got a text alert telling them to shelter in place immediately. According to Chief Charlie Beck, the LAPD chief, he says that witnesses reported three shots fired, maybe more. They're trying to confirm how many right now. But that there were at least two, and there are two victims down, so that would make sense. But then people immediately tried to get out of the area. But the warning went out for them to shelter in place, and that's exactly what they did.
Is that like, you know, we have the emergency alert system everywhere. Is that what it came over, where people would get a text? Because what a great thing to get on your phone to warn you to get out of that situation.
Yeah, a similar setup that they've got, except it's just for campus staff and students. It's called Bruin Alert. And it immediately goes out via text and email and whatever each individual person says that they want it to go out to. And it tells them to immediately shelter in place and to know that there is a threat on campus. And it's something that has been developed, and a lot of colleges use it now in the era of mass shootings. And that's something they utilize today, even though it turns out this was not a mass shooting. It appears it was a murder-suicide. They didn't know what it was.
they immediately implemented the Bruin alert, telling everybody on campus to shelter in place.
Alex, if you missed this, I apologize. I didn't hear you say it, but was UCLA, were the classes still in session, or were they breaking for summer already?
You know, this is finals week, so everybody here was, they're dealing with finals, getting ready for classes to end, and it was a very, very busy day on campus. We understand from those who were on campus when it happened, they say it was a busier than normal day because everything is coming to an end, and folks were dealing with the end of classes and trying to wrap things up here.
So what is the next step now? They believe the area to be safe now. Both the shooter and the victim, sadly, are gone. But what happens now in the next few hours there?
Well, the coroner moves in and begins that investigation. Right now, police SWAT teams, they're still searching the buildings just to make sure, even though they don't believe that there is a threat. They are orderly getting people out of those buildings. They don't want it to be a mass exodus of people who have been hiding. So they're going through and telling those who may not have heard that it's safe and they can come out. And they're coming out somewhat slowly as they begin to release this scene. And then things will begin to calm down here. I mean, it's still a parking lot of hundreds of police vehicles parked all over the sidewalks and up onto ramps and everywhere where they came to rest, where they went running in. And things are beginning to calm down now. As I look at police officers standing around their vehicles or chatting, they're beginning to end this and beginning to leave.
And this happened, what, just after 10 a.m. L.A. time?
Exactly, just after 10 o'clock. And it took probably a good hour for the full response to get here, an hour and 10 minutes. They continued to get SWAT vehicles in, not knowing what they had at that point as they went into to clear these buildings, and then didn't take very long after that for them to realize what they had.
And as we should repeat, the scene is safe at this point. That's been confirmed, Alex?
Yeah, the scene is now secure. Police are saying this was a murder-suicide, that both of the suspect and the victim are dead inside of an office building in the engineering building here. And they say that they don't believe that there is a threat on campus at this point.
Thank you so much for filling us in with all those details. We appreciate it.
You got it. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Alex. Have a good day. That's Alex Stone from ABC News reporting live on the scene there at UCLA, where there was a shooting earlier today. And as you heard, both the victim and the shooter are now both are both dead.
I love that app, though, or that alert system.
Mm-hmm.
What a great idea, because you wonder what's happening.
Right.
And then, lo and behold, you get a text. There's a shooting situation, a live shooter at UCLA.
Yeah.
And then where do you go? Just in some empty classroom? What if you walk into that classroom?
That's something that people always say is that's a little chaotic because you don't know exactly what areas are or aren't safe. So
I would try to run off the campus, but then you don't know where they are.
Yeah.
Very scary. All right, break time
break.
Right now.
Yeah, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and then more shows. Stay where you are. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder on WGN.
This is the perfect music to introduce our next guest, Rick Hogan.
Well, usually on my show I play bongo players, but that's a little laid back.
Yeah.
Well, I listen to you Sunday nights.
Do you?
I love your show.
Really?
I just love your voice.
You seem surprised.
And I love what it says.
Are you sleeping on a my? You're lying on a my pillow.
I am.
That's fabulous.
With your face on it.
That's great.
That's the newest thing, ladies and gentlemen. Get your father a my pillow with my face on it.
Oh, they'll love it. Dads will love it.
Oh, all fathers would love that.
I have a compliment I need to pay you. You wrote about Bill Zamy a couple of weeks ago, and what a great piece that was. So informative. And I know Bill, I know what a struggle he's had of late, but he really, of all the writers of our generation, he was able to get in and talk to Carson and Letterman and all the key players in late night TV, and you chronicled that beautifully.
Well, Bill was at the burning hot center of the entertainment scene here for such a long time.
Yeah.
Then he got involved in this Johnny Carson book. He's the last guy Carson was not the friendliest guy in the world, but he agreed to let Bill interview him. And Bill has tons and tons of tapes and was working for 5 years on the ultimate Johnny Carson biography. Then he gets sick. He got a diagnosis. When you go to the doctor and he says, well, this doesn't look too good, and Bill says, well, what is it? He goes, well, it's stage 4 colorectal cancer.
Good God.
And to Bill's ever-loving credit, I don't think I could do it. Does he go and ask, well, what does that mean? No. Does he go to WebMD and look it up or Google it? No. I think that's one of the reasons he was able to withstand it all. I'd go to WebMD, take a look at it. I would go immediately down to Billy Goat and drink myself to death.
Yeah.
Right.
To death. Yeah. But he beat it. I had dinner with him last night at his favorite place, Twin
better.
Anchors. He's skinny,
yeah.
But he's doing much, much better.
Good.
He is clean now.
Yeah,
clean.
That's fantastic. Good, good, good. Well, you always do a good job.
I wanted to finish that Carson book, though. That's
yeah,
what I really
want. Well, let's all hope. Let's all hope.
All right. Well, you have something going on. I've heard about this Printers Row Lit Fest. I know you do.
Maybe next year I'll interview Bill Zamy at Printers Row Lit Fest. Mm. This year, no Bill Zamy.
No. All right.
Whom or what will you be interviewing? What are you talking
about
this year?
Well, about me. Lit Fest has become, over the last couple of decades, an extraordinarily popular event. And extraordinarily popular because you think to yourself, wait a minute, no one reads books anymore. Everybody reads e-books. It's crazy down there, which is what makes it so much fun. It's all free.
Mm-hmm.
You've got dozens of authors speaking, some very famous. I don't know if Ethan Hawke, the actor, qualifies as a famous writer, but he's going to draw.
Oh,
he's
sure.
Draw. And that's what people come down, they'll go and listen to some goof interview, some goof like me interview some goof author, and then they'll wander around and buy books. I mean, it's an open marketplace. It reminds me of Paris is famous for that, these open marketplaces of books. And it's so good for me as a writer to just see people buying books. I don't care if they even looking at them, picking them up, and just digesting them and being there for this thing.
I've never gone ebook. I have an iPad. I got one book on there, and I can't read it like that. I have to physically touch a book. I have to smell a book.
Same here.
To carry a book.
Same here.
That they opened an Anderson's bookstore right in our hometown, so it's walking distance.
See, that says something good if they're still opening bookstores.
Yeah,
yeah that's
I've lived
good.
Through. There used to be, five bookstores within two blocks
right.
of this
oh,
place,
I know.
The great Croc and Brentano's.
They had a Croc and Brentano's in Croc and Brentano's for a while. Remember that? You could go in there. Rick, in our family room.
Now you can go in and get coffee at bookstores.
Right, it's changed that dramatically. In our family room, we have an entire wall, top to bottom, that is all bookshelves filled with books. And a friend of mine came over and said, do you realize we are the last generation that will have something like this in our house? Isn't that
no
sad?
No question. Roger Simon, who's a political columnist, you can still read him in the Sun-Times. He used to be here for years. He told a great story when he went from South Shore High School down to the University of Illinois. He moved into his dorm, and he put his books in there, and he was rooming with what he found out later was a football player. Not that football players are dumb, but he asked one of the great questions. He came into the room, introduced himself, said, Roger Ambruno, or whatever his name was, and Roger, it's great to meet you. And he looked at the bookcase that Roger had filled with books, and he gets this quizzical look on his face, and he's like, what, these are your books? Yeah. Have you read them all? Yeah. What do you still got them for?
Oh, no.
Which is a pretty interesting question. It begs. The reason people keep books is they have, they don't reread them. People don't go back.
Bill does.
I do.
I do too sometimes.
I can't.
There are very few. There are probably 10 books that I've reread over and over and over again. But I thought that was such an interesting question because in many cases, it's to show off.
They're trophies.
Yep.
They are kind
but
of,
in
aren't
other,
they?
But in other ways, they're memories, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where were you? When did you read that? What did you think? I think it's a fascinating thing.
Yeah. Wendy and I were discussing this very topic a week or so ago, and there are certain books that I've read 5, 6, 7 times, and the reason is I'm a different person each time I read it, and I understand and appreciate.
Which was brilliant when you said that.
But it's true.
It is true.
It is true. It is true. That's like, talk to any kind of jazz singer, male or female. And they will tell you, okay, yeah, I'm still singing Body and Soul, but every year or so, because of the events that have affected me emotionally, I see more in the song or I bring more to the song. I think that is true.
Yeah, yeah.
That is one of the most profound things. I never look at you and go, that Bill Laff, boy, is he profound.
Boy, is he a deep thinker. Boy,
but honestly, that is so true. Oh. I read Catcher in the Rye in high school. I should revisit it now.
You would
To Kill a Mockingbird.
It's the same story, but it's a different angle. I mean, it's obvious.
You see it differently.
Yeah, I did not think as much of Catcher in the Rye the last time I read it about 10
years
ago as I did when I was 17. What, 17?
That was it. That was the book.
Yeah. I actually need to read a book that would change my life. Like something like How to Be a Millionaire or something.
Tell him the book you reread frequently. I want Rick Hogan's opinion on that.
I love The Great Gatsby. I just I love everything
that
about
is
it.
So funny. Me too.
You're the same.
Me too.
I just think it's the most tragic story of any book I've ever read because it's a man who has everything and nothing at the exact same time.
It's kind of the story of your life.
It's the story of my life, right?
Except that Gatsby didn't have a radio.
That's the only difference.
And he dressed
that
much better.
That is the only difference.
Right.
Well, plus the end, the last paragraph of that book is among the most stunning writing.
Yeah.
In the millions and billions of words that have been written. The other book I reread because of the ending, too, is A River Runs Through It by Norman McLean. I mean, oh, my.
That's so good.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
He will not be at the Prince
Norman McLean will not be attending, nor will any of the authors we've discussed so far.
Yes, I think Fitzgerald is going to read a play somewhere, and Salinger has lost
time. He's not coming.
He wouldn't have come if he was alive.
No.
But it is fun. I mean, you do get to, you know, sort of up close and personal, even the audience. I did a couple years ago, Eric Larson of Devil in the White City fame, who's really good at these kind of presentations. Many of the authors do this, not as a living, but they like to go out and meet their readers. There's something very special about it. And that bond, and they're generally really real. I've never seen... You know, the famous, like, you know, the drunken Hemingway beating up somebody in the middle of Dearborn Street. You know what I mean? Most of the authors who do this are very, very, very nice people.
Shall we take a quick break and continue talking about this with Rick Hogan?
Rick Hogan's here. If you want to call in, please do, or text in to 312-981-7200. It's us. It's Bill and Wendy, along with Rick Hogan on WGN.
We have classed things up by
just a little.
Yes, we're talking about. I was planning to read Genesis, but Wendy forgot her
in
Bible.
In the beginning.
Wendy forgot her Bible. The Printers Row Lit Fest website is printersrowlitfest.org. There's also this kind of cool. I don't do a lot of apps, but if I did apps, I would get this app, Printers Row App, app.com. Which gives you like updates about what's going on. If you're going to LitFest, it
you get the schedule all on the app.
You can get the schedule online now, but you'll get updates. I think you get free books, free ebooks, $5 off some stuff, interactive ticket reservations, which some of these things, the Eric Larson thing was a nightmare. I mean, there were like 300 people more than we could fit into the auditorium because people love Eric Larson.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The guy I'm interviewing, I have not met him.
Rick Hogan in the studio, by the way, in case you didn't identify the voice.
Sebastian Younger, who wrote A Perfect Storm, and I'm going to show you this picture of him. When I have mentioned this to, they say, who are you interviewing at LitFest? I go, well, Tony Fitzpatrick is one of them. Oh, yeah, I like Tony. He's a good guy. That's a really bad imitation of a woman talking.
That was supposed to be a woman. It sounded like me.
I can't do a woman talking. Yeah. It sounds like someone who just got out of the billiard after 8 hours. Tony Fitzpatrick. I really like him. Maybe I'll come see that. Who else are you interviewing? I go, Sebastian Younger. The response would make any response to Ethan Hawke seem mild. They go, oh, my God, that guy is so hot.
Really?
I go, but that's not what you should say about authors. You should say he is so intelligent.
Right.
That's him. Yeah, I've got to show to Wendy.
Let's see. Okay. Wendy, drool factor on a 1 to 10?
He's a writer. He goes, I mean, he's a very adventuresome writer who goes off into war zones to report on it. And he's, A Perfect Storm was his big book.
Yeah.
And it, but Tony Fitzpatrick's also interesting. You can have
Tony's
coffee.
Tony is Wendy's former radio partner, you know.
Oh, of course.
Yes, and I think we're going to have him up. He's got a couple of books that are fantastic. He writes poetry. He's an artist.
He's
and this guy is hot, by the way.
Thank you.
But Buzz Aldrin's hotter.
I expect to see you at your first LitFest, don't I? Sebastian, please welcome Wendy Snyder. This is her first LitFest. And he's probably like put his arm around you. Go, well, Wendy, here's an autographed copy of my latest book called Tribes. Tony's got an amazing art show. An amazing art show at the DePaul Art Gallery, which is right at the foot of the Fullerton L stop in one of the nicest gallery spaces I've ever seen. Ever. This new DePaul Museum.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
And he did some recent work after Prince passed away.
Yes.
And, of course, album covers for Steve Earle and Lou Reed. And
Tony's a total workaholic, too.
He really is.
When do I do him? I think he's in the afternoon on Sunday. They don't have Tony's picture here, Wendy. It's like your boyfriend, new boyfriend, Sebastian Junger.
What are you trying to fix me also, up? I'm married.
You'll notice in the Litfest thing that I think is in this weekend's paper, Ethan Hawke gets a relatively small picture. R.L. Stine from Goosebumps. Yeah, Goosebumps fame.
Oh, I love those books.
I think he wrote like 80 books for Goosebumps, didn't he?
Yeah,
he's very prolific.
He actually doesn't need to come here.
No.
He could just sit on it. He could just lie on his My Pillow with my face on it and relax for the rest of his life.
You mean my Sebastian
Pillow? But you will notice
pillow?
The two largest pictures available in this calendar that'll be in the paper this weekend are Sebastian Junger, who I think does not have the same name recognition as Buzz Aldrin.
Oh, right.
Buzz is an interesting interview. I'll say that much.
Well, he's been in space.
Yeah, he has been in space.
He still is.
That's the reason. Who knows what happens when you go up there?
Yeah, we've talked to him sometimes where he's a fantastic guest.
And really nice.
Yeah.
And then other times
sometimes he's
kind of a little nasty. Different.
With nasty, would you say?
Yeah,
or just
crabby.
Kind of curly?
Yeah, a little crabby.
You
know, at this thing, you also get to, you can have coffee with John Cass one morning.
Oh.
And a smoke?
And you can have coffee with Eric Zorn and Mary Schmeek.
Oh, well, that's fun.
I don't know if the coffee is free, but you can make a whole day of it because the events are all day, and you just pray for nice weather. There was one year when I remember Karen Abbott of Sin in the Second City was there. I remember I thought to her myself, it rained so hard and blew over tents, and she was so soaking wet that I thought we needed to have a wet dress contest
for the authors.
Oh, yeah. She would have won, hands down. But it's just a really nice way to spend the day. I think that's the same weekend when they're having the, America's Cup to do.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
Which I would not be able to understand for 5 seconds. I would just see
racing?
These boats go. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're boats, right? I don't understand where they go or what they do. Yeah. America's Cup is beyond me.
It's kind of like the way hard to keep score, isn't it? It's
the way I feel about soccer. I said, why are these guys running so fast?
I don't get it.
Why are these guys running so fast?
When does this start?
It is the weekend after this. It's Saturday the 11th and 12th, and it's been, there are people who go every year, and they make a real,
oh yeah, it's
they make
a big deal.
Weekend of it.
Yeah.
They make a weekend of it, because you don't have to, I know you can, C-SPAN books, and one of the things about authors is they don't do a lot of radio anymore.
Yeah.
And they don't do, there are no, I can't think of any authors. Sometimes Carson would have a writer or an author on, but not often. So you're
used to have Calvin Trillin on all the
time. Yeah, because he was funny.
Yeah.
Sure, because Calvin's a very interesting, fun writer. But you don't get the exposure of these people. I suppose you could go on YouTube and find some boring hour-long interview, but writers are probably the only sort of artists short of sort of people who make sculptures out of cotton candy or something, who don't know. You have no connection with them because you don't see them in the media.
That's so true.
Yeah.
I'm always fascinated by their process. Some writers will tell you that the best thing for them, for their mind, is to be in a blank room, a room that's just doesn't have anything in it so that they can create whatever they want.
Like a padded room?
Not a padded room.
Like a padded cell?
Just like a white room with just nothing that could possibly distract them so they're
forced
to create.
That would be distracting.
Wouldn't it kind of?
I think that would drive you nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, Stephen King, for instance, has a jammed huge office filled with stuff and he plays rock and roll at top volume. And Stephen King's as prolific as any writer I know and is good.
Yep.
He gets a bum rep. He gets a bum rep.
He does a nice job, doesn't he?
I think he's really good. You like him?
Yeah, I'm a fan.
I think he's great. I just read Mr. Mercedes. You know this? It's the first in a trilogy about some very weird guy who runs over a bunch of people and then gets kind of, in touch with a retired detective who he's trying to kill. And I'm not going to spoil the end. It ends at a concert.
Oh.
It ends at a concert.
I like those twisted paths that Stephen King lays down.
It's interesting mind. One quick story. My first book was called Dr. Nightlife Chicago, a collection of nightclub columns I did for the Sun-Times. And I'm so excited. I'm like 25. And I'm invited to a books authors event at Marshall Fields, the old Marshall Fields. And so I'm up there and I'm really excited. They take me to a table. Who are the people on my left and right? Stephen King and Jim Davis, the cartoonist of Garfield. Sure. There are lines for those two stretching into the housewares department.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there. I get one friend from high school. Oh. One friend from high school comes over and he goes, "Hey, it's great to see you. How much is your book?" I said, "What's like $7.95?" He goes, "Oh man, I haven't got it." So, but the nicest thing, both of those guys felt so sorry for me that they each gave me a book.
Yeah,
Stephen King and Jim and signed autographed it.
Yep.
And bought one of my books.
Oh, that was nice.
So somewhere in the rock and roll office of Stephen King,
is
Dr. Nightlight. I would think. I would hope.
That is Dr. Cool, Nightlight. Rick.
They were so nice.
That's perfect.
That's what hooked me on these literary events. It hooked me forever.
That's so funny.
Well, this kicks off next weekend, is it?
Yes. Not this weekend, but next weekend, the 11th and 12th.
Printers Row Lit Fest, and I believe the website is?
PrintersRowLitFest.org. And perfect. Look up this app, too. Look up this printersrowapp.com.
Thank you, Rick. Always
my
good
pleasure.
To see you.
It's great to see you. I see you guys coming in and out of the
we
building.
Wave back and forth.
We're stalking
Bill was like
you.
When I came in, he goes, "Thanks for coming down today." I go, "Oh, it's the worst commute I've ever had." Well, it could be, depending on who's on the elevator.
Sure, of course. That's so true. Thank you, Rick. It's Rick Hogan, everybody. A quick break, and then we'll find out what Rowan Anna have next. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder at WGN.